Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom, and welcome to the Pardes Institute, where we're meeting with Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, shalom and welcome.
Oh, shalom, Yishai. Good to see you.
Good to see you, and it's good to be back here. I just got I was coming here, and I'm a little bit late because the police pulled me over. I kind of went into or drove through a crosswalk while a pedestrian was in the crosswalk.
Sounds messy.
I pulled the Manhattan thing, which is like that pedestrian saw me, I saw him. I wasn't in any way impeding him.
You went with the flow.
I went with the flow, and it was on a downhill, and I just kind of swooshed right. Police nabbed me, and that helped me finish the 20 minutes that they made me wait to give me the privilege of paying them 500 shekel. Let me also, another mitzvah is that they give me the chance to finish up the Rashi for the Torah portion. So thank you, God. Thank you again. What an honor it is to get a 500 shekel fine to pay to the state of Israel from an Ethiopian police woman while finishing Rashi on a sidewalk in Jerusalem.
That's a modern Jewish story in a nutshell.
What a gift! It's a
kapara b'maman v'lo b'guf.
Right, and also it just feels like it's something that Shai Egnon would tell. Okay, Rabbi Mike. Yesterday, I had a privilege. A colleague by the name of Ben Goldstein, who's this incredible guy, who is this like he lives in El Azar in Judea, in the Gush Etzion, and he also gives the soldiers tons and tons of equipment, all kinds of sights, lights, knee pads, better helmets, and he just gives them this kind of stuff. He organized yesterday a tour of the Gaza border. Got to see the Gaza border yesterday. I've been wanting to see that for a long time. Also took part in a celebration of the youth movements that they had yesterday in the Gaza border, and it was supposed to be scheduled for last week. Lo and behold, 500 rockets came down.
We call that a rain delay.
It was rain delay. It was rained out.
It was raining down rockets. We're going to delay that.
So two fascinating things is that I saw, I told you before the show, a wall being built down into the ground up to 62 meters to the water table underneath it, so to block tunnelage.
It's just incomprehensible to me. It's like, as we said before when we were chatting, I just find it hard to conceive, both in the scale, in the cost, but what's most heartbreaking to me is in this sort of fixed posture of, you know, I think of in the book of Devorah, I mean, sorry, in the Song of Devorah in the book of Judges, when she says, you know, until I came, the people were afraid to live in open cities. That there's this sort of mentality in our land right now that the solution to everything is higher walls.
Right.
And when we look at our history.
Or lower walls.
Or lower walls, yeah, right. As the case may be.
Higher the other
bigger.
Way.
Let's just go bigger, okay?
Yeah.
And we know our history. We know the history also, by the way, of warfare. Such things don't bode well.
Right, right. And the citizenry, the residents of the South said to me, they're building these crazy walls, but the war we're facing now is the balloon war.
Right,
and the
just
rocket war.
Right over.
Right, so what are you, you know, so it's like defend, defend, defend. And that reminds me of something special on today's show. The second half of today's show will be a presentation from Rabbi Stephen Przanski, one of my favorite, and I say this in quotes, American rabbis. He's not exactly an American rabbi. He's really one of the rabbis who straddles somehow. He lives in America, but he's always bringing the land of Israel to his shul and his shul to the land of Israel. And he's really, I think he's a very important person because he's a bridge. And without his Eretz Yisrael side, he's also an incredible teacher, an incredible guy. And he does something similar to you a little bit in that he teaches history. He has a different style in a different way. And he's got classes, different classes on history. And this week I caught it through an RSS feed that he gave a long talk about the history of Rabbi Meir Kahana. Mm. And I was like, ooh, interesting. And it's an absolute must listen. I WhatsApped him and I said, Rabbi Stephen, can I please put your audio into my podcast? He said, absolutely. And so that's in the second half of the show. But what you just remind me of is that there's a story that he's gonna that you're going to hear later on. He says that, Rabbi Przanski says that something like 1972, there was a mugging in Brooklyn, and a Jew was killed, was murdered in this mugging because he had no money because it was Shabbat. So
right.
The assailant murdered him. So there was two prominent Orthodox rabbis who debated whether Jews should be permitted to carry money on Shabbat so that if they were mugged,
they'll have mugger money.
Right. And so Rav Kahana mocked them, and you'll hear him say that word, that he mocked them saying, you know, there are other things that you could carry to stop the mugging.
Yeah, other than payoff money.
Right, but they didn't.
They didn't get it.
You know, it didn't come to them naturally. So there is a mode in the Jewish mind sometimes to go defensive, and we'll learn about that in this week's Torah portion as well.
Oh, we sure will.
And we'll take a break in the middle to talk about a little bit about some of the other things that are troublesome.
Got a lot on your mind right now, huh?
Well, there's a lot going on. There's the Airbnb thing.
That's okay? True.
Airbnb, big American company. It's not just American, by the way. It has some of its headquarters in Ireland. That may have had something to do with it. Airbnb has decided to pull its listings of Jews in Judea and Samaria.
Yes.
Specifically, some people are calling it racist. Some people are calling it discriminatory. I'm just asking, like, are you really even getting into politics? Like, why do you even decide that? I thought you were a business of providing people a way to go into people's homes.
Yeah, well, this is the whole posture of the BDS movement, is to make that bridge between economics and politics. It's a powerful bridge, you know, and one that we should be aware of. So I don't think that there's anything surprising in my eyes of business getting pulled into politics. In the end of the day, money talks, and they're not probably doing this from ideology, but rather from a sense of a fear that their institution could be damaged by the lashback if they don't fall into line.
Right. Well, basically, let's just fill that in. Your guess is right, but I'll just fill it in that there were two organizations, Human Rights Watch and another organization, which I couldn't understand the name of exactly, some kind of weird name. These two organizations have been badgering Airbnb for 2 years and released the day before the release of a report that said bed and breakfast in the occupation or something like that, and the whole blackening of the eye of Airbnb. Of course, the Israelis are releasing a lot of information showing, hey, Airbnb, you're doing business in Turkish Cyprus and in Western Sahara, et cetera, et cetera. You're not deciding those conflicts, so why would you be deciding it here? You know, actually, I would like to kind of shift into somebody else's voice for a second.
Is it going to be high-pitched?
Well, it's not so high-pitched. It's actually the BBC. They're very professional.
Sure.
And the BBC yesterday interviewed Gidi Kelman, a kind of great character in Gush Etzion, who lives in Zdei Boaz, which is a hill close to Neve Daniel. And mm-hmm. He was on the BBC, and I think that he answered really great answers and even made a Kiddush Hashem. So let's listen to the BBC interviewing Gidi Kelman about Airbnb.
Well, the Israeli government has criticized the move, and we wanted to speak to someone who owns one of the 200 properties affected. So he called up Gidi Kelman, who has one of them.
We've been hosting people very successfully from all around the world, obviously Israelis and people from all around the world. And we love doing this. We love giving people an experience of tranquility and peace and quiet, and leaving the Western speed outside and relaxing a bit. So that's the idea.
And where is your place?
My place is called Sde Boaz. Translation is Boaz's Field, which is basically 20 minutes from Jerusalem driving south. We can see Bethlehem from our porch and Jerusalem. That's basically it. The chalet is called Ruth's Home. Ruth, the great-grandmother of King David. We don't know exactly the location of the story of Ruth, but it's somewhere close to Bethlehem. So that's where we are.
So what is your response to what Airbnb have announced?
Well, I think it's a hypocrite, anti-Semitic, cowardly decision. That's basically discriminating Jews from a certain area of making a living. And I think it's hypocrite calling it politics or occupied this and occupied that. I didn't see any action against Turkey when they were bombing the Kurds, or any action against Airbnb people in Syria or in Saudi Arabia or in Russia. There's a lot of countries that have different conflicts and different arguments. I imagine thousands of Airbnbs in China, although they're oppressing people in Tibet. So that's hypocrite in my eyes.
But just because they're not acting differently in those other places that you list doesn't mean that they shouldn't where you are. I mean, people might think, well, hang on, let's just talk about the place where you are, which is in the West Bank, which under international law is seen as occupied, although of course Israel disputes that assertion. They are entitled to do what they want, aren't they, as a private company?
First of all, yes, they are entitled to do what they want. I think in America there's a law about discrimination, so I'm not sure about the law in other countries. I think if you'll ask me about a law that won't sell to gay people their produce, or to black people, or to Jewish people, that's a problem.
Sure.
And I don't think an international company should be dealing with politics. I think they should be dealing with business, making money, and actually some credits Airbnb, which I think they're not using. I think Airbnb is a wonderful platform of connecting people. And if they would use their platform of bringing people, not to hotels, but to people's home, this connects people, makes people sit down and talk, which is the best way for peace all around the world. So if I would be an Airbnb, I would say the logo of Airbnb should be Airbnb connecting people. If people want to make peace between Israelis and Palestinians and close gaps between different ideas, preventing income to any side is a bad idea. I would say exactly the same thing if a Jewish-owned company, like Airbnb, for example, would say, I'm not selling my produce to Palestinians because they have a quarrel with Israel.
And I guess so, what Airbnb would say is that they're not targeting specific people, they're not banning a particular group of people, whether Jewish people or Israeli people.
They're banning only Jewish people living in settlements.
And it's the living in settlements bit that is the crucial thing here, isn't it? When you talk about whether a company should get involved in politics, I guess the issue that they were grappling with at Airbnb is to either list in those settlements or not list in those settlements. Either of those decisions is seen as political.
Well, all the idea of BDS is trying to uproot Jews from their homeland.
And we should just explain what BDS is. It's this movement to boycott, isn't it?
You know, there's a whole bunch of these organizations like Roger Waters, which I grew up on his music, and I loved Pink Floyd, and I think the music's fantastic, but the truth is I can't listen to it today. So that's very sad for me.
What about the other options that you have? Surely people might think you can just let out your place on some other platform.
Well, obviously, the Airbnb is not the only one. It's, for some people, very crucial because a lot of their clients came through Airbnb. For some people, it's more. For some people, it's less.
Do you think it will make a real dent in your business then? It will be a real problem for you to attract people in some other way, such as the reach, I suppose, of this platform that you won't be able to use in future?
Well, first of all, my specific establishment is not based only on Airbnb. Mm. I will suffer damage. It won't do significant harm to me. There are people that it will do significant harm to. And I believe that my income comes from God. I'm a believer and I'm optimistic. And if you heard of David Ben-Gurion's quote once, he said, in the land of Israel, if you don't believe in miracles, you're not realistic. So we believe in miracles and we are optimistic and we believe that the good will shall prevail.
Ah, I love that last line. That was such a great line that he said, that God provides his parnassah, his welfare. It's just like to say that
people
on the BBC and to say it so calmly, like, I believe in God and God is going to take care of us. And there's other ways for people to reach me, come stay in this place. And kind of I tweeted like, it's a boomerang for Airbnb. It's like, you got no blessing in that. You're cutting
out. No, for sure not.
All right. So there was that. Also, another thing that's bothering me, just a schnickel, is that,
let's get it all out of the way.
Is that right now on Monday, there's a WANASI conference. I mean, a gathering in the Knesset of Knesset members who are calling for the ousting
that. Hebron of, first.
Right, ousting of Jews of Hebron. Let us make Hebron Judenrein.
Yes.
Hebron Tchila. Let us.
That's what they're calling it.
Yeah. I was like, are you guys funny? Is this a joke?
It's a sick joke.
It's like a sick dark joke.
Yeah. Gosh.
And the other side of that is that the Knesset member who's leading the charge, his name is Ayman Uda. I've spoken about this in the past.
Yes.
This guy, Ayman Uda, he's an Israeli Arab. His whole clan exists unharmed only because the state of Israel protects them in one of the most beautiful parts of the land of Israel on the slopes of the Carmel Mountain. And they are a clan that's on the out with the rest of normative Islam, if such a thing exists. But anyway, they're again the Sunnis hate them because they think of them as some kind of Shiitish type of thing. How do you become a Shiitish, like a little bit Shiite-y, by not exactly believing?
You don't toe the line.
You don't toe the who's the next prophet, and they're,
yes,
like,
it's they have the, like, descent of the prophet, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
They have like a Latter Day Saints type of thing going on where they're like,
listen,
no,
we Jews are splitters, not lumbers. I wouldn't start throwing stones at other religions. I mean, have you noticed the news lately about the Jews can't get along?
Yeah.
That's hardly new.
Oh, yeah. You'll hear more. Also, Rabbi Stephen Przanski in the next half talks about how in the latest issue about Trump saying people should have guns in shul. Mm-hmm. So a Reconstructionist female rabbi says, you know, if they make us change how we pray, they'll change our whole religion. Right? Like, if we have guns in shul. And then Rabbi Stephen Przanski is like, isn't it ironic that she's like a Reconstructionist?
Yeah, for all they make us change, right? Oh,
those good times. Anyway, all right. Speaking of splitting, this is the Torah portion of splitting. There's all kinds of splits in this week's Torah portion. This is the
good segue.
Right, yeah. This there's a lot of splits there. We'll be splitting the camp. We'll be fighting. Jacob will be fighting this other. That other may be him or in his mind or maybe the angel of Esav. But there's a wrestling match. And then there's all kinds of
split opinions further on.
Split, and then there's also the splitting of Yaakov and Esav. They split up in this week's Torah portion. They get back together and split up. All right, so there we go. We are in the Torah portion of Vayishlach, which is Genesis chapter 32, verse 4 is the way we do it. And basically, this is the story about how Yaakov, who was away for 20 years from his from the land of Israel, is now going to be going back to face the music. He's going to try to visit his papa and his mama. He's not going to get to see his mom. She's going to probably be buried before he gets there. By the time he gets to his beloved father, there's going to be a lot of tribulations along the way. The land of Israel, P.S., you think you kicked the bucket, like, I mean the old kind of kick the bucket, the kind where you, like, Ali Ali oxen free or whatever, like, when you get home, when you're home safe in the zone, like, it's not so pashut to come back to the land of Israel.
Okay? No, for certain it is not.
All right, so let's go through the first tribulations. First one is meeting of his brother. Mm-hmm. Now, his brother likes to murder folks.
He's got a bad rap. I mean, we don't really know what he's been up to, but right. The very idea that Yaakov is afraid is reasonable. Although, let's not forget that Esav's anger might just be justifiable. But the fact that he's coming to meet Yaakov with 400 men is just deeply ambiguous. I mean, it could be an honor guard.
Right.
It is possible that he was just looking to show his brother some sort of great kavod, some great honor, but at the same time, it strikes one as a war party.
Right.
Although the truth of the matter is, as you pointed out, it is actually the first meeting that Yaakov has, because before he ever gets to his brother, there's a major inner struggle that he's got to face.
All right, so let's go through it. So basically, Yaakov hears from his own emissaries, his own reconnoiters, that Esav is coming.
Sayeret Yaakov.
Right, Sayeret Yaakov. They're coming towards him with 400. That Esav is coming towards him with 400. Of his men,
big hairy men.
He seems to understand that it's wartime. He famously does three things, right? He's going to split the camp up, but he's going to also first he's going to prepare presents, waves of presents, right? And here's Yaakov. Some people understand it to be, again, he's using psychological games, warfare,
the appeaser,
and also why not give all the gift at one time? Make it fluff it out, make it look, tease it out.
It's all in the strategy.
Right, strategy about the presentation. Okay, so again, maybe Yaakov, the semi-trickster, there's a reason I'm saying this in a second, he's going to split up his camp, saying, okay, if my camp, this is not exactly seemingly a Jewish idea. Jewish idea is unity. No, here he says, I'm going to divide, and if one camp gets killed, the other one will survive. I got to hedge my bets here, right? And he prays and maybe even prepares for battle as well, one way or another, but he turns to God and verse 11, let's read verse 9. It says, Vayomer, and he says to himself, or he decides, Im yavo Esav el ha-machaneh, if Esau, my brother, comes to the camp, ha-echat, one of the camps, v'ikau, and he destroys it, he kills them, v'aya ha-machaneh anishar le-pleita, and the second one will be a remnant that will survive. Then he says, Vayomer Yaakov, Elohei avi Avraham, v'Elohei avi Yitzchak, Hashem ha-omer alai shuv la-artzecha u-le-moladetcha, v'etiva imach. He says, the God of my father Abraham and the God of my father Isaac, the God says to me, come back to this land and to your birthplace, and I will do good with you. And then he says, very famously, Katonti mikol hachasadim, I have become small from all the kindness, or either it means I'm not deserving of your kindness.
I'm too small for what you've done, or I have become small because
you've already
done.
Given me what I kind of deserve.
I got my payout.
So katonti mikol hachasadim umikol haemet, and from all the truth, asher asita et avdecha, which you have done with your servant. Ki b'makli avarti et hayarden hazeh, with my cane that I cross over the Jordan. Vata haiti l'shnei machanot. Now I have become two camps. Awesome thing, awesome thing that I learned from the Gaon Mivilna. There's a question in the Talmud that says, how much should a student of Torah, how much haughtiness should he have? One opinion says zero. Mm-hmm. And the other one says an eighth of an eighth. An eighth of an eighth.
And 1/64th.
1/64th says the Gaon Mivilna. What is the eighth parsha? Vayishlach. What is the eighth pasuk? And it's in different, it could be a different verse number, but it's always the eighth verse. The eighth verse of the eighth Torah portion is katonti mikol hachasadim mikol haemet. Like even a Tamid Chacham, like the one little bit of haughtiness is that he has to say, like, Hashem, you've given it to me, and I've become small through you. That's the Gaon Mivilna. Any case, so he says, all right. So he says, and he prays to God, protect me. And he sleeps that night. Okay, and he sends, and he's sending, in the meantime, he's sending all of these incredible gifts. A lot of, I measured it out to be at about $10,000 to $20,000 worth of gifts.
You worked this out?
I worked this out. I counted the number of sheep. I counted the number of sheep.
Multiplied them by the going rate.
Multiplied by the going rate, converted it to dollars.
Did you adjust for inflation?
No.
Okay, so this could be quite a bit more.
Right.
In real value?
What today's value is, it would be about $20,000. Okay, a lot of money as a gift. And then something kind of strange happens, and that is that he instructed all the folks, saying, in this manner shall you speak to Esav when you find him, and you shall say, moreover, behold, your servant Jacob is behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the tribute that precedes me, and afterwards I will face him. Perhaps he will forgive me. So the tribute passed on before him while he spent the night in the camp. Now something happens here. He crosses over the river. Mm. He pushes his camp kind of over the river, and he ends up somehow by himself. Somehow he ends up by himself. And then there's a very famous verse. Vayvater Yaakov levado. Yaakov is left somehow by himself. Vayavek ish imo. And a man wrestled with him ad alot ha-shachar, until the morning dawn. But so the pasuk says he was alone.
But somebody's there wrestling.
But somebody's there with him, okay? So the Freudian kind of side would be like he's struggling with an inner struggle with himself. The Rashbam says something I never heard before. He says he was trying to run away from facing Esav.
Yeah.
He didn't want to face him. He decided not to face him. Send the gift, send this and that, but I don't have to face him. Somehow let me
bail out.
Let me bail out. And this man, either it be a psychological or actually an angel. And it seems from the text that it was an angel, because this angel will bless him and will give him a lot of information, is trying to stop him from running away. And I'll finish off and I'll give it over to you, which is he also hurts him in the joint of the hip.
Yes.
Stops him from being able to run away.
You can limp, but he can't run.
You can't limp. And he says to him, you're no longer Jacob. Jacob's not your name. You're not the trickster, Jacob. You're now Yishar El. Here in this land, you got to be Yisrael. You got to be straight on.
Straight to God.
Straight to God, but like you got to do things like in a straight manner and not in a curvy manner. You got to face this head on.
Well, you got to take the struggle, which is the other meaning of the name. I mean, I think that this whole inner dynamic that is set up for Yaakov is a dynamic around the struggle with fear, right? I mean, it says before Esav ever appears that Vayar Vayetzelo, right? He was afraid and it really troubled him. So he's facing his life in an extreme way. He's not just afraid of Esav as a military force. He's also afraid of looking in the face what he's done. Remember, they're twins. Esav and Yaakov are two sides of the same coin.
And the Torah portion will remind us of this by recurrently saying his brother.
His brother. Right? Because in the end of the day, they are two faces of what could be. And the fact that through this struggle, through facing his inner fear, when a sorrow shall Esav, the prince of Esav, is he's facing that part within himself, which is the same as Esav, because the trickster and the murderer on some level face the same problem, which is that both believe it's their power that can win the day. And it's true the trickster takes the devious route and the murderer takes the sort of the frontal forceful route, but each one forgets the fact that really it's in God's hands. And so Yaakov's in great danger so long as he remains in that posture of Yaakov, trying to, like, you know, do the end run, as we sometimes translate his name. Right? And this is his moment. That's why the whole emphasis here is on, like you said, the head-on, face-to-face meeting.
And speaking of head-on, they kind of, as they're come, so in the, after he gets this, oh, so he wrestles, there's the wrestling match. The wrestling match will end with a kind of...
technical foul.
Right. what's it called? The even score. What's it called?
Tie.
A tie.
Draw.
Right, that's draw. But at the end, the angel needs to leave. It's sunrise.
He says,
I gotta go. I can't be wrestling with you all night. And he says, I'm not going to leave you. I'm not going to let you go until you bless me. And he blesses him and he gives him a preview. This is my contention. It's the preview of what's going to be your name, because you're going to get your name.
That's how Rashi reads it too.
Right. It's like you're going to get
God will give you a new name, but this is what it's going to be.
Right. It's going to be Yisrael.
Yep.
And it's going to be because Kisarita imelokim venashim vetochal, because you were able to wrestle with man and God, with God and man, and you were able to.
You can do it.
Anyway, so now once again we kind of see that Yaakov from time to time needs a assurance. As he's leaving the land of Israel for Haran, he gets an assurance. God is with him. God says to him in Haran, it's time for you to go. As he's about to face his seemingly wicked brother, he is again reinforced.
It's a theme that repeats itself later on in the Tanakh. Al tira avdi Yaakov, right? Don't fear Yaakov, my servant. Because in that respect, Yaakov is every man, right? He, as opposed to Yisrael, who is his ideal self. Right? Let's not forget that Yaakov is the only character in the entire Bible whose name is changed by God that doesn't stick. He maintains these two sides to himself. It's because I really believe that in the story, he's meant to be both. He's meant to be every man who, of course, lives in fear. And fear, if anyone isn't aware of it, to wake up, smell the coffee, is one of the great inner drivers of human behavior. Right. And perhaps the greatest barrier to growth, creativity, health, success, you know. But nevertheless, the reason that it persists is because good reasons. It makes perfect sense that he's afraid right now. He's not irrational. So he needs that sense of God holding his hand.
I sometimes think about Yaakov and Israel as Clark Kent and Superman. Now, like Batman, Lahavdil, he was not like his fake persona or his social persona was not like a loser. He was a
wealthy,
aloof.
Yeah, sort of aloof. Sort of a millionaire or something.
Right.
Type.
Okay. So that's okay. Being that's a cool. Millionaire is cool. But being a kind of nerdy reporter that bumps into things all the time.
Right.
You know, and there's a little bit of Yaakov, like there's the more fearful side, but like you mess enough with it, suddenly the Israel side comes out. Okay.
Shinis Kederot.
That's right. Okay. So anyway, they bow down seven times as they approach, as he approaches Esav. And Esav runs towards him. Okay, there's the he like runs towards him. Is this an attack posture? Is this an embrace? And he hugs him, and he falls on his neck, and he kissed him.
But dun,
the kissed
dun,
him.
Dun, dun,
that's
dun.
Right. The kissed him has a dun 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 because it has these little dots. And if you listen carefully, to those dots they go dun dun dun.
Yeah,
right?
So those dots mean actually.
Right, and what it means is that the rabbis say that he bit him. That he tried to bite his neck.
Yeah, it was a couple of things they say there, but that's one of them.
That's one of them.
Right? The other one is that, you know, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, right, says that, no, we're supposed to really read this as he kissed him with all his heart. But we know halacha psuka, right? It is a determined law that Esav hates Yaakov. Nevertheless, in this moment, his art overcame him and he actually loved him.
Right.
I've always struggled with this idea that there's just some intrinsic opposition. But I'll tell you that not only do I struggle with it, there was a time when I just seemed like rejected out of hand. It's just wrong. It's a traumatized mentality. And there are all kinds of good psychological reasons you could come up with it. I remember when I first came to the land of Israel and it was the midst of the Oslo War, which some people like to call the Second Intifada, right? And as you recall, it was horrendous.
By the way, Prime Minister Netanyahu, in a speech Sunday night, called it the Oslo disaster. I noticed that he said that. He said the Oslo, they brought upon us the Oslo disaster. And so, yeah. Okay.
He's trying to regain his grip with the right now.
Maybe.
But my point was is that I watched this phenomenon occur. Like, here we are in the middle of Jerusalem's bombs every few days, people dying, blood in the streets, momish.
Yeah.
And the world is screaming at us. You awful, evil people. Why don't you take better care of your murderers? It's like, I lost the ability to digest. And the only thing I was left with is, well, I guess Rabbi Shimon was right.
Yeah. No, there is a
not really sure what to do with that.
There is a determined hate in this world. It's hard to swallow because it might not sound reasonable.
Yeah, you'd think that the grandchild of Holocaust survivors would have gotten that. But I think that part of me doesn't want to accept a world in which such a thing is existential as opposed to sort of sociological.
In the next part of the show, they'll talk about how the organized Jewish community wanted to get rid of hate. But Rav Kahana was saying, you can never get rid of hate, but you can't get rid of the haters. I mean, so you can't get rid of hate as an emotion. That's preposterous. That's not. You're never going to do that. But what you will do is you can push back on the haters. That you can achieve. And I guess.
Yeah, well, one of the great dangers of what happened actually in their quest to get rid of hate is what they did is they pushed hate out of public spaces. You know, this is my mother, who worked for the Anti-Defamation League for many, many years, has pointed out that the great failure of all these movements, and especially in the organized Jewish community, was to make hate speech in particular completely unacceptable and to think that they'd actually gotten rid of it.
Right.
When in reality, what it did was it pushed underground with a deep resentment about the inability to control public spaces, and then it came roaring back in the last 5 years or so.
Right. And it's better when the haters speak their mind and you can identify them.
Yes.
And when they learn how to be tricky, how to be devious, how to be subversive. I heard some Russian generals say, look, the KGB idea is subvert everything.
Yes.
Yes. I was like, oh my God, I believe them too, you know?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Because then you lose any solid ground.
Right.
But it's not just that it's better that you can identify them. So the reality is that hate becomes powerful when it links itself up with the truth. I mean, there are real claims and real issues that the haters manage to latch onto, and however small they may be, magnifies their stance. So when they're out in the open, you can start to blast away at these things, deal with the real problems, but don't accept the lies.
So I just want to add the famous, what I think is famous. It's not so famous, but I think it's famous.
It will be now.
Right. The Sfat Emet says that the rabbis don't have the power to change. He kissed him too. He bit him. That's gone too far. You don't have that power. He goes, no. The rabbis were right. What it means is Esav's kiss is as great as bite.
Ooh.
It's his kiss that is the bite. And that actually, if you keep going with the text, you see that actually it keeps going, which is Esav's like, come, let's hang out together.
Yeah, let's stick together. Back to my place.
Right.
I'll leave some of my folks with you.
And Yaakov will have none of it.
No.
He wants
it's
separation.
Split. He wants the split.
He wants that split. Okay. He sees Esav gets to see all the blessings that Yaakov has amassed, including finally he sees all the concubines, the handmaidens. Then he sees Leah and her children, and then he sees Yosef and then Rachel. Meaning to say, Yosef is the son. He kind of gets in front of Rachel. Rachel is obviously still a very beautiful woman, and somehow dangerously potentially in the clutches, you get the sense of this Esav, and somehow she's kind of protected. And that's going to be an interesting thing, because this protected Rachel is going to be one who also dies in this week's Torah portion as she enters the land of Israel, more or less. So he says, who are all these people that I met? And he says, he says, they are to gain favor in my Lord's eyes. I've given you gifts and all these other things.
The whole thing is very sort of ancient Near East feeling. They're bowing to each other. They're giving gifts. They're speaking in this sort of third person language.
Right.
Make a great drama.
Yeah, it would. And it is a great drama. And here's an interesting line. He says, Vayomer Esav, yesh li rav, achi. Esav says, I have much. And I remember Yitzchak's blessings, which is Ravi Avot Zair. No, not Yitzchak's. Sorry. The when Rivka's asked,
the
when
prophecy.
Rivka asks, and it says, what's going on in my womb? And it's told to her that, amongst other things, it says that the many will worship the
well, the elder will worship the will serve the younger. Rav Yavod Zayir.
Rav is elder in that sense?
So it's the way it's understood. But
I
just
thought it meant like
the same word.
I thought it meant like the many, which is the world, will still be subservient anyway to the Tzir. In any case, here he says, Yeshli Rav. I'm happy he's got a Rav, right? That's already good. But it says, Yeshli Rav, and meaning to say, admitting.
That's the nature of the relationship
right,
between them.
Right. Yeshli Rav Achi. Yelcha Asher Lach. Yelcha Asher Lach. You should have what you should have.
Yeah.
In any case,
keep your stuff.
Right, and he said, "No, take the blessings for me." And he finally takes them, and then they basically have this effort to split up. Esav wants to somehow stay close. Yaakov wants no part of it in the nicest way possible,
or just simply no part of it.
Right,
you know, it's the nicest
way. No, but he
way.
Says it in a nice way. He says it like, "I."
Well,
you know,
he also you get a little slip back in there of his deceiver self because he says, "I'll meet you there."
Right.
You go on ahead. I'll meet you there.
Right. They actually have explanations for that.
Well, I mean, it's an important explanation. Actually, Rashi brings the messianic vision in
right.
that moment, and it's an important one to think about in our day because you know, in the rabbinic mind, Esav becomes Rome and becomes Christianity.
Right.
And in many ways, when Rashi says, well, when's Yaakov finally going to catch up with Esav? When are they going to be able to actually walk together? He says, you know, in the vision of the Mashiach, Ve'alu Moshim Hartzion, Lishpotet Har Esav, right, that the Redeemers will go up on Mount Zion in order to judge the Mount of Esav. And that's when they're going to come back together. And it could just be that we're beginning to live in that era today as a relationship which was, let's just say, fraught over the last 2,000 years has potentially become much more of an alliance.
I have to say this because it's just the right time to say it, which is, and I know it's not the most popular thing, but it is funny to me that President Trump is the reddest individual I've ever seen in my life.
What do you mean reddest?
Red.
Physically
the reddest person you have ever seen.
Why is that funny to you?
Because some people say that he is the Gilgal of Esav. They say that.
Oh,
he,
really? I haven't heard that out
yeah,
there.
Yeah, no, they say that he might be a kind of, what's a Gilgal again?
Reincarnation.
Yeah, is that it? The reincarnation of like Esavian tendencies. Mm-hmm. Many of them seem Esavian. And yet he's got this incredible redness about him. This, I mean, just color wise, he's unbelievable. Like it looks like you think your TV is like
off.
Yeah, you gotta like change the. Remember, I guess we don't do that anymore. But you know, change the
red,
contrast.
Yeah, the contrast.
You know,
yeah.
But he's the reddest guy I've ever seen, and he's taking steps to undo some of the worst Esavian things that have been done in a long time. And he's got these other Esavian qualities, maybe. Anyway. Be that as it may. If you like that or don't like that, send me a hashtag that says something like
what?
Trump is Esav, Tikkun of Esav. Is that right? Is that wrong? I want to hear what you think. And that's going to be fun. Oh, so that reminds me. We have a new sponsor for the show, and that is the Israel Bible. A wonderful, wonderful creation.
Oh, I just saw it in our Beit Midrash upstairs.
It's a wonderful creation.
It was
really
very impressive.
Is. Yes, and it's Rabbi Tully Weiss, who's the editor of it, and a lot of smart people contributed to it. And basically, it's a Koran Bible in English and in Hebrew, but it has kind of texts explain certain texts explained, especially when it comes to the land of Israel and the importance, sanctity and centrality, security, and all the other S's involved in the Superman of the land of Israel. So I want you to go check out the Israel Bible right now because of, I don't know, Thanksgiving and other holiday thingamabobs. There is like packages that you could get for a lot cheaper and they have sales on it. And it's all at theisraelbible.com.
All right.
TheIsraelBible.com. That's a lot of fun. I'll also want to mention that this coming Tuesday is Giving Tuesday. Okay? It's Giving Tuesday. That's a whole thingamabob in America where...
It is?
Where people give...
Justice
donate.
Tuesday.
It's like a Tuesday for giving. It's a Giving Tuesday.
All right, keep us in mind, folks.
That's right. So keep us in mind. Rabbi Mike, you got your new brand coming out soon.
That's right.
And but people can go already to your website.
They can go to RavMike.com right now.
Okay, RavMike.com. That's very exciting. YishaiFleischer.com. Also, our hosts of this network, which is thelandofisrael.com, and the fabulous project of the retreat, which Ari and Jeremy are building, which is just one of the most moving things you've ever seen.
What's this? I didn't even know.
You know, the farm.
Oh,
the farm.
I thought you meant there was like a retreat coming up.
No,
yes.
The general farm retreat.
With a capital R.
So that's so you have a lot to choose from there. You got Rav Mike. Did we say RavMikeFoyer.com? Is that what you
said? It's just Rav Mike.
RavMike.com?
RavMike.com.
Boom. That's just that easy, okay? And then there's YishaiFleischer.com. There's thelandofisrael.com. And also I want to throw in our great friends and where I get to work every day, which is Hebron.org. No, Hebron.org.il. But actually, we send you to HebronFund.org. That's what it is, HebronFund.org. Hebron.org.il is the information website for Hebron, which is run by our good friend Ben Bresky. Does a great job. But HebronFund.org, fabulous website to support the building, and thank God we're involved in some very exciting building here in the Land of Israel. Okay, so that was the Giving Tuesday pitch plus the Israel Bible pitch. Good. I'm very happy that I did that.
Check.
Thumbs up for me. Okay, so Yaakov then goes Sukkot. He goes to a place called Sukkot. He builds a Sukkot for his livestock. He builds Sukkot for his livestock and calls the place Sukkot. And that's one of the hints that the holiday of Sukkot is associated with Yaakov. And finally, he comes to the first place. Sukkot is still across the Jordan River. He crosses into the Jordan River, as many do. For the first time, when you come to the land of Israel in ancient times, one of the first places that you get to is
Shechem.
You get to Shechem. Why is that? Well, I learned this by going to my friend Natan's house, Natan Shachar's house in Alon Moreh, and he took me up to Har Kabir, and he showed me with my own fleshly eyes, I saw what it means, why it is that Shechem is the first place. There's a giant valley that comes up from the Jordan Valley called Nachal Tirza, the Tirza Valley, and it just swoops into the middle mountain range.
Yes.
It's just an open, instead of being a hard climb, it's this like big
easy
valley,
path.
Easy flat path that you just climb up the mountain, and it leads you right into the kind of the first city, which is Shechem. And if you don't know where Shechem is, that's what the Times of Israel will call Nablus. Okay? Times of Israel, is that a little dig there? Okay, I don't know if you know this. Nothing personal, but I mean, you may not know this, but that's like calling Jerusalem Ayola Capitolina, okay? We don't use the Roman names, friends, okay? Okay. What have the Romans given us?
What do the Romans ever do for us?
Okay, there you go. So they don't know that at the Times of Israel. They need to, maybe we can help them figure that out. In any case, what does he do there? Very important. He will purchase a plot of land in Shechem. That's how the Gentiles, the English-speaking Gentiles say it. That's how the King Jamesers say it. They say Shechem.
Shechem.
Okay, and over there at Shechem, he buys a plot of land. That plot of land is going to be where the tomb of Joseph is going to be. And that's one of the three places purchased by the forefathers, but not just the biblical characters, King David, the Temple Mount, Jacob, the tomb of Joseph, and Abraham.
So you can't miss that one.
That's right. I'll be fired. Tombs of the forefathers and mothers. Okay, then there's one of the hardest stories in the book of Genesis.
Perhaps in the Bible as a whole.
Maybe one of the real tough stories, probably in the Bible, that story with Benjamin.
I said one of.
You're right. Okay, so, and this is the story of Dinah going out and just trying to check out the stuff. She's going out in Shechem, checking out what's going on over there. And there's a guy named Shechem ben Hamor. His name is Shechem. He lives in Shechem. His name is Shechem. He's all about Shechem. But he's the son of a guy named Donkey right there.
Which apparently was not an awkward thing in his time.
Right. It's not an awkward. Maybe like, wow, Donkey, like Chazak, right? and he's a Hivite. And he's an important, he's a prince of the land. And guess what? He takes her forcibly and violated her. And then it doesn't always happen this way, but he fell in love with her. By the way, the Kabbalah here has a lot of stuff.
Oh, there's crazy stuff.
There's crazy stuff here about the souls that are involved in this thing. And I'm not holding in the...
Neither am I, nor do I think that we want to go there.
Right, but I just want you to know it's more than meets the eye.
There's a lot of layers to this story.
There's a lot of layers. Anyway, so he falls in love with this girl that he rapes, and he wants to marry Dinah. And he tells his father, I want to marry Dinah. They sit down for a
powwow.
A powwow. Thank you. That's exactly what I was looking for.
I know it was
a powwow with the clan of Jacob. And before that, Jacob hears that Dinah, his daughter, has been violated, and he didn't tell his sons immediately until they come in from the field. He didn't go running out there. He's, again, kind of maybe there's a fear factor here.
He's trying to be strategic. I mean, this is the prince of the land.
Prince of the land, and they're hanging out in their town. And this Hamor, this man named Donkey, the father of Shechem, comes to Jacob, and he kind of says to him, you know, they say what happened, and the brothers are despondent. They are upset.
Distraught.
Distraught because... Because
their sister was brutally violated.
That's right. So here's the thing about these guys. They come out, these Shechemites, maybe these guys are Nablusites, okay? These Nablus folks come out, and they say, you know, my son really likes your daughter a lot. He really likes her a lot. He wants to marry her. How do we become like one peoples? We'd love to marry your daughters. You'll give us your daughters and take our daughters for yourself. Meaning to say, all the action is on you, right? You'll give us your daughters and take our daughters. We won't give you our daughters. And you'll actually make it in the land. But you'll make it in the land.
Let's be one people.
This reminds me a little bit about Mrs. Potiphar. It's similar a little bit. Mrs. Potiphar is like, come with me. And there's some medrashes that say that like Joseph thought maybe this is a good pathway to unite with her to achieve what I'm supposed to achieve. If Jacob's supposed to achieve, and okay, so his daughter was raped. It's very unpleasant. But maybe these people, okay, it's an unpleasant path, but maybe I should unite with these people.
Listen, this speaks to the core tension, I think, that Am Yisrael lives in the world, which is that on one hand, we define ourselves as other. And that's core to our mission.
Right.
Right. On the other hand, our mission is to the whole world. So therefore, there has to be some place where we join together.
Right.
Right. And how to negotiate that tension is far from simple. I mean, you brought up Yosef, who is the model of leadership in exile. So his struggle there is particularly fierce because he has no grounded home, right? He's been sent out from his land. Here, Yaakov and his sons are still in the process of re-entry into the land,
right?
It's because a fundamentally different posture you can take in relationship between Am Yisrael and the world when we're a people in our land, when we have a place to stand, which is our own, and therefore relate, so to speak, eye to eye with the world, as opposed to when we're in, as is in this case with Shechem, we're guests. And it's true, he purchased this plot of land, but it's very clear whose city it is, as you said. Right? He's being sort of cagey in his negotiations here because he's on thin ice. And it's always a problem to know how it is, how do we bond? How do we make that attachment?
Right. It's great what you're saying. But in this case, the initial impetus for it is foul.
Well, I would argue the initial impetus is almost always foul. If you think about it, how did Yosef get to Egypt?
Well, that was foul in the end. In the end, there was no binding between.
I understand,
the Jews
but even the question that arose there, as is here, is not a moment.
I'm saying
there are
for example, when Abraham was in the land, so he finds B'nai B'rit.
Yes,
he finds people of the covenant that are with him in covenant.
So we have models, you're saying.
Right.
We have models.
And this model starts bad.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not coming. As we say, he's not coming from a good place.
Right, and so that's perhaps the indication of how you can tell the difference. Interesting.
Right. Okay. So So then they're in some kind of negotiation, and somehow these two brothers, Shimon and Levi, split off in negotiations. And they say
they form a faction.
They form a faction. Is that what you said?
A faction.
That's right. There was a faction, a caucus.
Yeah, well, or a more violent underground movement.
Right.
It's the Lehi of the sons of Jacob.
By the way, Lehi. I always thought about. I know you just did a podcast on Lehi, which I haven't finished yet. I want to say Lehi also reminds me that Lehi reminds me of Samson. You know, that word Lehi also is an acronym.
Yeah, sure.
But it's also
it refers to the Samson story, right?
The Samson story, which is
the jawbone of the donkey with which he slew the Philistine.
Come on, say it biblically. Come on.
The donkey jawbone.
The jawbone of the ass. Come on.
With which he slew the Philistine.
That's right. He slew the Philistine. That's right. Okay. The chamor chamor time haragti elef ish, right? With I killed 1,000 with the jawbone of the aforementioned. In any case, so the brothers say, we can't marry you into you guys. You can't marry into us. We can't have a mixture because you guys have something that's gross to us. That's kind of gross to us, and that is
foreskin.
We don't do that. We don't roll with that. Okay, and it's a disgrace for us. That's also very Middle Eastern, right? It's very Middle East to very kind of ancient world to be like, that is, like, you can't say that today.
Anathema.
Right. That is just ewy to me that you have that, or it's some kind of.
I mean, it's funny that you mentioned that it's very ancient Near East. I mean, it's very true. There were many cultures. You know, for instance, we get a hint of it in Joseph's story when he sets a table for his brothers who don't know that he's their brother. He ends up setting three tables, one for the brothers who are Israelites, one for the Egyptian servants in his house, and one for himself, because the Egyptians, even though he's the master, won't eat with him because they know he's not an Egyptian.
Right, because he's a Hebrew, and right. it's ewy.
We don't dine together. Right, we just don't do that.
It's like so not today. You cannot even.
This is one of the great challenges of the Jews today, and our whole posture is there. We keep the line, and that's how we maintain our selfhood. And the truth is, we've been doing it longer and better than anybody else. So you can criticize all you want, but it works.
Right. Any case, so after negotiation, they convince the Shechemites, these Hivites, to actually circumcise themselves.
It's a big ask. It's impressive that they succeeded.
It's a big ask, and I think actually within that big ask is why we're going to see in a second that Jacob's going to be upset. In any case, they are like, look, all we have to do is circumcise
a minor
yourself.
Surgery.
A minor surgery, but maybe, you know, we know now, today we know that it really helps stave off many sexually transmitted diseases. And maybe, you know, we all know that foreskins oftentimes, ostensibly, I don't know, you know, that's what I've read, that they can become, what's it called? They're prone to disease.
Don't know where you're going with this one.
No, it's something, you know, I can understand. I can understand that they're saying, okay, you know, like this might be, I'm just trying to
seems
think.
Seems like an upgrade.
It seems like it's going to be okay, and we're going to get all their money. That's what they basically say.
Yeah, we're going to absorb them.
We're going to absorb them, and they're obviously wealthy, and it's just going to be good for us. All we have to do is do this minor surgery.
Picture this. Right. Picture the meeting. The town hall meeting.
Everybody's like, what?
Wait, say that again?
Yeah, right. So the
it all
Bible
sounded
says,
good until you said what?
Right. And then the Bible's like, they were like, no, we're not doing this. No, no. The Bible
everybody
says,
goes for it.
Everybody's like, no, okay, great.
Line it up. Sorry. Let's move on.
Oh, my gosh. Let's move on. Oh, man. Anyway, this is a great line. There's a great line here. There's such a pun, such a biblical pun, biblicalpun.com. Okay? Ha'anashim ha'ele shlemim hem itanu. They are whole with us. Okay? They're whole with us, but we're not whole because, or like we need to be less than whole. Our wholeness is not good because we need to be whole with them. We need to say they're being truthful with us and peaceful and whole, and all we have to do is circumcise ourselves and to become
remove
whole.
Something to become whole with
right.
them.
Right. There's a play on word there, and it's also a play on word that Yaakov a little bit earlier it says he comes shalem to Ir Shechem. He arrives whole, maybe healed from his limping or others, or in any case, overcoming the first challenge, which was his brother Esav. Anyway. So they convinced the whole town to do that. And it was on the third day after the whole town circumcised. Now, they should have been smart. They should have staggered their circumcision. But no, as you said, it was all in one big circumcision day. It must have been like a crazy day. And the whole town becomes circumcised, the menfolk in any case. And on the third day, which is known in the Bible as the day of the hardest day of healing, the most painful day after a surgery of this kind, come the two sons of Yaakov, Shimon and Levi, who are the brothers of Dinah, says the Bible. They are her brothers. Meaning to say, the Torah signaling to us.
They weren't going to take it.
Right, they weren't going to take it. And they come with their sword, and they come unto the city in surety, with assurance, betach, and they kill every male. And they, of course, kill also, it says, specifically Chamor and Shechem, his son. They run them through. The fichara, right?
The mouth of the sword.
Right. Oh, is that what it is? Is that what it means, the mouth of the sword?
No, the fichara really is the edge.
Right. Okay. I thought it was like, okay. In any case, And they took Dina and they left. Not only that, they also plundered the city that had defiled their sister. By the way, interesting, it says, Vayavozu ha'ir asher timu achotam. They plundered the city itself, which defiled their sister. Somehow the city, anyway, all the inhabitants, somehow they were in cahoots.
Well,
there's definitely what people here at Pardes would call, what's it called, punishment? Collective punishment.
Well, and this is actually one of the explanations that the Rambam gives for how such a brutal act could be deemed appropriate by the brothers, the sons of Jacob, which is what does it mean that the city did this? So the Rambam says, we know that one of the seven mitzvot of the seven commandments of B'nai Noach, of the descendants of Noach, is to create a justice system. Right? And clearly, if the son of
And arayot are illegal. Sexual immorality is also part of that. You're not allowed to rape under the seven laws of
No, no, for sure. And so therefore, you're supposed to have a justice system which will punish people for violating, right. You know, for grabbing a girl by the well, for violating her, and then coming up with some story that you love her and you want to marry her or whatever it is. So the Rambam points out that actually the entire city is liable for this act. Mm-hmm. And that's perhaps why the language there indicates that it wasn't just, you know, Shem ben Hamul who did this.
Right.
Right. It was actually the entire city.
Right.
But it was culpable.
Interesting. In any case, after the end of that, they come out of there, and Jacob says to them, you have... they took all their wealth and they took the captives and they brought it back to the house. Jacob said to Shimon and Levi, you have discomposed me. Is that the word? That's the right word there? You have,
it's better than decomposed.
Achartem, yeah, achartem oti. I thought
you've muddied the waters.
Right. You've made, making me odious.
Odious.
Amongst the inhabitants of the
gosh.
Land. Yes. I smell bad amongst the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanite and the Perizzite. I am with a limited number of people. So that if they were to band together and attack me, I will be annihilated, I and my household. And they said to him, should they treat our sister like a harlot?
Right.
That's the end of that. Right. And it's one of these awesome things where the Torah is like, period, go figure it out. And Jews, I think, have been arguing forever. And really, even the commentators, was this the right, good thing or bad thing? Caveat, at the end of the book of Genesis, Jacob will not agree to this act. He will.
He gets the last word.
Right. He gets the last word, which is like, you did bad. You did a bad thing.
He curses their anger.
He curses their anger. He splits them up.
Yeah.
Now, my friend Natan Kotlarov, years ago, I remember where we were standing, where he told me his explanation for this, and I never forgot it. He said that and Natan Kotlarov lives in the Golan Heights, at last I checked. Nice guy, Russian Jew. What did he tell me? He said to me, what really angered Jacob, what was wrong here, is that they didn't just go to straight war. They used coming closer to God, coming closer to the Jewish people,
as a tactic.
Circumcision. They used holiness in the name of violence.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not appropriate. You want to, now he doesn't say that really, Yaakov here. He says like,
no, but
you,
it's good reading. Right? I hear it.
He says like, you want to go to war, okay? But don't use God's good name tachsis, what's that the English word?
As a strategy or a trick.
Right,
or
right, as a stratagem or whatever it is.
Yes.
A fraud.
There's something very familiar to my historical ear in this exchange. You know, Yaakov, I mean, because there's truth being spoken from both sides. Yaakov's got a pragmatic perspective. He says, listen, we're a small clan. You're going to make the whole land rise against us. Anyway, they're the settled agricultural folk. We're the invaders. They don't like us. You start swinging swords around here, it's not going to end well. What do the brothers say? There's a moral imperative. There's a moral imperative. Like, it's true, your pragmatism, but it's a moral imperative. And in my mind, it triggers the debate about restraint, right? During the 1930s here in the land of Israel, where, you know, the Arab population had awoken to the fact that we weren't going away. And that perhaps we had, let's just say, slightly opposing views on whose land this was and what ought to be done with it. And there was a lot of fear in the establishment of, listen, don't make waves. When they kill a few of us, let it go, or we'll let the British handle it. But if you muddy the waters now, if you stir up the Arab world against us, they'll overwhelm us. I mean, look at the size difference. And you had the Lechin, the Irgun eventually, you know, or really the Irgun from the beginning, but they broke off the path saying, but we can't let Jewish blood be hefker. Right. We just simply can't.
You know, you went to the 30s, and you're totally right.
But oh, it's got much deeper roots.
Last week we had that. Last week we had an amazing conflict in the country here, yes, in Israel about Gaza. They fired 500 rockets at us. Our forces showed total restraint. Yes. Other people read that as a worse thing than restraint.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell you that I was in the South yesterday, and the language that the average Southerner in Israel is using is that the government has mafkirotam,
mm-hmm,
ifkirotam, which is what?
Just leave them ownerless. Like, basically, I don't know if there's a good English word.
Right.
They've abandoned us.
They've abandoned us. And that's the language. They really feel that way. And they see it with their eyes. And they're tough out there. For example. And they're not like tough. They're not like settlery types. They're just good old salt of the earth people. Many secular folks. And I spoke to them yesterday. You know what they told me, by the way? That 2014, the Moatzat Eshkol, the Eshkol
Regional Council had
8,000 people living in it, and now has 16,000 people living in it.
Really?
They've doubled. I said to them, so there's a flight here, you guys are all leaving? They're like, no.
Where are you going to go, right?
There's nowhere to. They mean to say the people are moving in. There's not an apartment empty. And I was very, very surprised about that.
Listen, I mean, there's so much more there. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but there's also, I think, a deeper fear.
You brought out restraint.
Right.
Versus.
Yeah.
Pragmatic restraint versus.
Versus a moral imperative.
Moral imperative.
No, I would agree with you.
Right, you know, and
I would agree with you. But part of the problem there in the South is. Just that lack of vision that keeps coming back to haunt us.
But moral imperative is a related thing to vision.
Imperative at a certain point says you're right, I don't know how this is going to end, but right, I can tell you this, it can't go on like this.
Right. Anyway, the tension is here. We have to speed up. How much more time do we have, Rabbi Mike?
I told you hard stop at 12.
Yeah, but then you said something, you made a caveat.
You have
5 minutes or what?
I got about 5 minutes.
Okay, 5 minutes. So here we go. Good. Hey, like, when we have Rabbi Mike, we just got to use him as much as possible. That's just the way
it is. Tell that to the guy I'm making late for his meeting.
That's right. Okay. We're going to tell him in a second. You know what the truth is? We really have two more sections, and they're really very quick, which is one, very moving, and that is the return of Yaakov to his place of connection, which is Beit El. And he's going to come back to Beit El. He's going to call it Beit El yet again, and he's going to... he's going to come to this place. It's going to be called Luz, but it is Beit El. And then he's going to build an altar there where God revealed himself to him last time. And there, the famous nursemaid of Rivka is going to pass away, be buried under Beit El, under the famous oak tree there. And it's going to be called Alon Pchut, which is the
oak of weeping.
The oak of weeping. Why is that important to me? There is some beautiful giant oaks right at the kind of... at the place where we think was the dream of the ladder of Jacob in Beit El. In any case, God blesses him. He says to him again, I am El Shaddai. I am the God of fertility. Prayer of every fertile, grow big, become a nation, and the community of nations shall descend from you. Kings shall descend from you. And I'm going to give you this land. And again, Yaakov will make a pillar of stone once again. He's going to once again put oil on it, and he's going to call that place Beit El. Okay, he's going to call that place Beit El. And then, as he's leaving Beit El, and where is he going from Beit El? Beit El is north of Jerusalem. He's going to pass Jerusalem, and he's going to get to Bethlehem on the way to... What? Why are you laughing? What did I say?
No, I'm just... there's a polemic under there about the whole location of Rachel's tomb that nobody's aware of. I heard the very clear directions of the map there.
We're
not going there.
That's why
I was smiling.
I and Jewish history and the rabbis all are in agreement that the tomb of Rachel is, guess where? Where you think it is, the tomb of Rachel in Bethlehem.
It's a surprise place, but the tomb of Rachel, and where the tomb of Rachel is.
That's right. Who's buried in the tomb of Rachel? You know, right. Like that.
Rachel,
like,
and her horse,
it's not
right?
Grant. That's right. So anyway, they're going down. They pass Jerusalem, correct? Hit Bethlehem, which is also the sister city of Ephrat. There, Rachel will die on the way. She'll die on the way. Very painful. There's something any feeling person can feel, the biblical, any feeling person could get a kind of hiccup, a tear well up feeling, that when we read this passage about that she is giving birth, to this son that was conceived of, I guess, in Haran, but now she's going to give birth in the land of Israel to the first boy who's going to be born in the land of Israel. As she's giving birth, she calls him the son of my pain, and Jacob overrides that and kind of calls him the son of my right hand, and she's going to die in that moment and going to be buried in this special place. Oh, man, Jacob, all you wanted was to come home to your dad, show him your wives and your kids, and have a nice house in Hebron. What did you want already?
You just get this sense of this entire parsha. I mean, listen, plenty of people suffer. I don't want to make it all about Jacob, but you get the sense that he's just being stripped of everything that he could hold on to, right? And there's a deep question in terms of what it means to root oneself in the land, and how the pain and struggle that he experiences all the way along, and then, of course, next week when he thought maybe he'd finally made it, then the whole rogue social Yosef, like the sages call it, this whole problem of Yosef is going to fall on his head. And I just have a lot of questions about Yaakov as an ideal. And we're B'nai Israel. That's how we think of ourselves. And really what it takes from us to root ourselves in the land, that there's something about the Jews for whom wandering is a place of comfort and security.
Well, at the end of those wanderings, there's 12 sons. And the Torah will list those sons. And once it lists all those children, that's when Yitzchak is going to get to Jacob is going to get to finally to Isaac, his father, in the Mamre, which is I told you before, Jabal Nimra today in Hebron, Kiryat Arba, he Hebron. That's where Abraham and Isaac lived, and then immediately Isaac is whatever amount of time they get to hang out, and then Isaac is passing away from this world, and his two sons Esav and Yaakov will bury him.
Yes.
And they bury him in the Marat Machpelah. The Torah doesn't say that, interestingly enough, here, but they do bury him there. We'll find out again later. And then finally, we're going to get a long list of the Esavian line. I mean, detailed.
Yeah, so incredibly detailed.
Detailed. Yes. I mean, who's who and what's what in Esav's world. You got to know. It's like sometimes you're like, should I follow American politics? Well, the Torah is going to let me know exactly about Esav's, you know, like the in and outs of Esav's life. And there's a lot of interesting lines there, including that there's two times in this Torah portion that the children of Israel future are mentioned. For example, here at the end, now these are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before a king reigned over the children of Israel. Rashi's going to say there's going to be an equal number of Jewish kings to Esavian kings.
I mean, there's also the very notion that the political structures of the world are often developed outside of Am Yisrael, and that our job is not necessarily to create the best political structure. Our job is to take the best political structure available and make it work for our people.
So
one of the big questions we have today.
Why did you say this?
Why did I say that?
I missed the connection.
Because the kings that ruled, that kingship was an institution within Esau before it ever came to Am Yisrael.
Right.
Oftentimes people make a mistake thinking, oh, we're just imitating what the nations of the world do. And the Ron, one of the great medieval commentators, just points out, like, no, that's not the genius of Am Yisrael. The genius of Am Yisrael is keeping God connected to creation, right? And it could very well be that the genius of other nations is to come up with these sort of sociopolitical even economic structures, and our obligation is to say, Gevalt, that's a good idea.
You're making such a good point about it's a fabulous point you just made, really. I think it's very important. I think people should rewind and hear that again. For lack of time, I'm not going to repeat it, but I heard a speech by Prime Minister Netanyahu this week, and he said, I did this and I did this and I know what to do, and I was like, sir, can you just throw in a Bezrat Hashem? Can you throw in a small
or even a we?
Right. Can you yeah. throw that in there? But a Bezrat Hashem, like American presidents would throw in, you know, in God bless America, throw it in there.
Yeah.
And it would tamper it just a little bit, because our genius, as you said, is to bring God into this world and connect.
That is, for this we were created.
Okay, I'm just tying it all together. We faced Esav, that overcame Esav, came into Shechem, purchased a plot of land. That's going to be Joseph's tomb later on, overcame the Dina story. And then what was after that? We dealt with Rachel,
yeah, the tomb of Rachel, Rachel, right.
The death of Rachel, the tomb of Rachel,
birth of Benjamin,
the birth of Benjamin, coming into the land, finally
burying his father,
again, a third burial kind of spot in the land of Israel. The three important ones are kind of three of the four kind of important type places are mentioned, and finally the lineage of Esav. I want to thank you so much, Rabbi Mike, for being with us today.
Always a pleasure. Sorry to run out.
No worries. And I also want to remind people to run out and write you an email. Rav Mike at thelandofisrael.com.
That's right.
Or me, Ishai, at thelandofisrael.com. And I want to finish off this segment right now with a song from one of the great musicians of our time, Yonatan Razel, who has a song about a verse in this week's Parsha, which is Katonti, Katonti Mikola Chasadim. And I thought that that would be a beautiful way to finish off this segment. But stay tuned, because much of what we just talked about and that tension between, how did you call it?
Between pragmatism and a moral imperative.
I like that very much, and I think that's what's going to be the name of the show. That is housed in the life of Rabbi Meir Kahana, and that's talked about through the auspices of the great Rabbi Stephen Przanski. Rabbi Mike, thanks again, and Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom, Yishai.
Stay tuned, folks. More great stuff on the way, so stay strong, stay connected, stay tuned. We'll be right back, and Shalom.
שעשית את עבדך קטונתי מכל החסדים ומכל האמת שעשית את עבדך קטונתי מכל החסדים ומכל האמת שעשית את עבדך קטונתי מכל החסדים ומכל האמת שעשית את עבדך כי במקלי עברתי את הירדן אתה הייתי בשני מחנות הצילי נינה
Right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, back as promised with Rabbi Stephen Przanski, who's the rabbi of the Bnei Yeshurun Synagogue in Teaneck, New Jersey. 600 families there, big shul. He's a lawyer, he's a great rabbi, and has a fabulous blog that a lot of people follow, rabbiprzanski.com. Check it out. And here is a fabulous speech which really inspired me to be that activist, kind of to keep going with the fight that we have for the land of Israel, and also learn from mistakes. But the point is the life and times of Rabbi Meir Kahana, who also my family owes not a little bit to, since my folks were behind the Iron Wall in the Soviet Union. In any case, wherever you are, you will enjoy this audio. So give it up for Rabbi Stephen Przanski talking about Rabbi Meir Kahana at Bnei Yeshurun.
We're talking about Rabbi Meir Kahana, Shem Kom Damo. Sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ili Nishnas, Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. Of all the rabbis in this series, so they're all great, but greatness comes in different forms. One definition of greatness, as I see it, is consequential, meaning rabbis who did things of consequence that carved a new path. So in that sense, Meir Kahana was great. One doesn't have to agree with every statement or action or policy position to realize and appreciate that he was a person of great consequence. As we've discussed in the past, great Rosh Yeshiva, great Poskim, leaders of Musar, trailblazers, all of whom solidified or innovated some aspect of the Torah world. Rabbi Kahana was a pulpit rabbi briefly, he was a Rosh Yeshiva as well. He was a writer of Svarim, but in none of those capacities did he make his mark. It was in a different realm entirely, related to all of the above, but unique to him. In short, he was a leader. A leader, though, who struggled to find followers. He was a trailblazer who immersed himself in so many different topics and who spoke his mind so freely that easily he's the most controversial rabbi we'll encounter in this series. He was a gadfly, he was a lightning rod, he was a person who spoke the truth as he saw it without compromise, without wishy-washiness, and he led in so many different spheres: Jewish self-defense, the plight of Russian Jewry, assimilation on campuses and in American life, the pitfalls of non-orthodoxy, Aliyah, the right of Jewish settlement in the land of Israel, the right of Jews to the land of Israel, the preferred way of preserving Jewish life in the land of Israel. Of course, there's a controversial plan to encourage or coerce the transfer of hostile Arabs from the land of Israel. His intense desire to create a truly Jewish state, a Torah state, and not, as he coined, a state of Hebrew-speaking Gentiles. He didn't mince words, and of course this did not endear him to the establishment, not the religious Torah establishment, or though some surprises await, and certainly not the secular Jewish or non-Orthodox establishment. Compromise was not in his vocabulary, and in that sense he was an extremist. My Rebbe, Rabbi Chait, used to say, not necessarily about Rav Kahana, that extremists are either completely right or completely wrong, but either way, people can't stand them. It's like the Jews who had to ask Moshe to utter the Dibros after the first two were uttered by God at Sinai, because the reality of God's presence was too overwhelming. So too, hearing the unvarnished truth is like staring at the brightness of the sun. People have to turn away. He's a Talmud Chacham, loved to learn Torah. His weekly columns in the Jewish press, for whom he served as an editor and columnist for almost 30 years, which was the main source of his paltry income, were peppered with Divrei Torah. And some of his works, for example, I have a few of them, but Or HaRa'ayon, about the Jewish idea, or Perish HaMakabi on different Svarim and Chumash and Nach, both contain wonderful scholarship and are great resources as well. So he went to jail many times. He was once threatened with jail time in Israel if he didn't discontinue his activism, and he said, "What's the difference whether I learn Torah in this room or in that room? It's the same Torah." And yet there was another side. He was passionate, and his passion sometimes gave way to impatience or curtness, occasionally even rudeness to people in the audience. He did not suffer fools at all, and although he loved to argue, he didn't love to argue for an extended period of time. I think of all our subjects, I probably had the most interaction with him, not that he knew me at all. I must have attended maybe 10 or a dozen of his lectures, because he was always entertaining and always on message. But at least in my experience, he would frequently insult and mock members of the audience with the sarcasm known to New Yorkers, maybe also people from Brooklyn, who knows. When he was running for the Knesset, one of the times I went to hear him speak in Netanya, and after he said that he hopes to win 3 or 4 seats, I asked him, who are the other people on his list? You know, you can't serve one person 4 seats. So he chewed my head off for asking such an impertinent question. To me, it seemed like a reasonable question. He never did answer it. He used violence as a tool to achieve his objectives, or maybe better said, we'll get back to this, the threat of violence. And he occasionally attracted people prone to violence also. On the positive side, he attracted many people to Torah and mitzvos who otherwise would have been lost. And on the other hand, some of them carried baggage with them, including a propensity for violence, some of which was a reaction to the Holocaust, when Jews were beaten and degraded and murdered. So he felt his generation could not accept it, and sometimes in excess. He loved publicity, I think he would say that himself, but he used publicity to draw attention to his causes. And that inspired a generation of activists, and often worked, but there's a personal price that's paid for the need for publicity. To feed that desire, you have to keep doing more and more. and even more and more outlandish things. So at rest and sit-ins and broken windows and bombs and threats and phone calls were all used to get attention. And he was a master at it, a PR master. I remember this vividly. There was once, probably still exists, a Reform rabbi in Miami who ran a conversion factory, obviously not valid. Kahana showed up at his temple one day, meaty in hand with a billy goat, and asked that the rabbi convert the goat, since the goat had a white beard. He looked a little Jewish, even more Jewish than the converts he was converting. If there was one common denominator between his activism and his Torah and his shenanigans, it was this. Everything was done because he loved Jews. Everything. He loved Jews who disagreed with him, who challenged him, who thwarted him. He felt sorry for them, and he redoubled his efforts. He desperately tried to get his contemporaries to love Jews, and often castigated other rabbis, Rosh Yeshiva, and leaders for their passivity, their acquiescence to the status quo, and especially what he saw as their fear and cowardice. Fear to confront enemies of Jews openly, midah keneged midah. Fear of making aliyah and leaving the flesh pots of the exile. Fear of teaching the whole Torah and not just parts of it. Just fear. Sometimes what he called fear maybe was prudence or a difference of opinion, but he saw it as fear. And for all the controversies he was involved with, and sometimes the harsh exterior, he had a heart of gold. He impacted the lives of tens of thousands of people, raising up disciples, keeping the true faith, bestowing chesed in hidden ways. So his wife, Libby, Shlif and Be Well, has written now two exhaustive volumes about his life, about 800-900 pages in all so far, covering his life up to the time he entered the Knesset. So she writes that during the Shiva, someone came and told her, maybe it was the person herself, that he once heard of a single mother in Yerushalayim who was on dialysis and finding it increasingly hard to get to the hospital. So he had no money, but he ordered for her a home dialysis unit, $7,000. On his next trip to America, he went to a wealthy person's home. The guy rudely greeted him in his bathing suit, wet from the pool, and within a few minutes, Rav Kahana had $7,000 that he needed to pay for the unit. I'll add, the woman was a complete stranger to him. So what drove him? How was he in the forefront of so many issues? Why didn't his life take a more conventional turn, remain a pulpit rabbi, teach in a yeshiva? How did he become such a legendary figure? And what was his legacy? The only rabbi in the series, Rahman al-Islam, to be assassinated and by an Arab terrorist at that. Well, Rabbi Kahana was born August 1st, 1932, in Brooklyn, in the nadir of the Depression, 3 months before FDR was elected for the first time. His father, Rabbi Yecheskel Shraga HaKohen, Rabbi Charles Kahana, was born in Tzfat in 1905. He went to learn in Poland, then in Pressburg, went back to Tzfat, and then joined two brothers in America, where he got a second smicha from Reitz. So his father became a pulpit rabbi in Brooklyn, spent much of his career at Shari Tefillah in Brooklyn on Quentin Road. This is Rabbi Charles Kahana, Sonia Trainin, in 1931, and her brother, Rabbi Isaac Trainin, for many decades headed the religious department of the Federation. So Kahana was frequently at odds with his own uncle. Rabbi Kahana Sr. helped reestablish the Mir Yeshiva in Brooklyn, where Meir would later learn. And of course, he has one younger brother. His younger brother, Nachman, Shalom Be Well, is today the Rav of the Young Israel of the Old City and the author of the famous Me Menucho series on Tosfos. In 1938, four of his relatives in Tzfat were murdered by Arabs. He was 6 years old at the time. During the attacks on Jews in that period, it was very prevalent, so prevalent that the Irgun was formed right then, the Etzel. Undoubtedly, the loss of the relatives had an effect on him. But what had a greater effect on him and his worldview was the Holocaust, to which we will return Americana 10, Yeshiva Flatbush, and then BTA. And really a typical upbringing for his era, baseball and friends. Very interestingly, he began to stutter severely in high school, and his parents sent him to a clinic in Rhode Island to try to overcome it, and he was a controlled stutterer for the rest of his life, blinking and using hand motions to distract himself from his typical speaking patterns, one of the techniques that he used. Very odd, considering that so much of his life became public speaking. So he arrived in high school, weak in Talmud by his own admission. Yeshiva Flatbush emphasized Hebrew language, but he worked hard, became the literary editor of the school yearbook. He had a lifelong love of writing. And he also in high school joined Beitar. Remember, this is the years right before the establishment of the state, and he was frequently out of school. It's not surprising that he joined Beitar, which became known for its protest demonstrations, all to call attention to the plight of Jews in DP camps, and of course in the land of Israel, fighting for statehood. Now, in tactics that would later be duplicated by the JDL, his Beitar group stormed on one occasion the British consulate to protest the hanging of Dov Gruner, Hashem Yikom Damo. They took over British offices, cultural institutions. He joined with his father's encouragement. He later acknowledged his father's profound influence on him. And he considered himself a devotee of both Zev Jabotinsky and then the Rosh Beitar, Menachem Begin. And really the Hadar of Beitar spoke to him. Jewish pride, dignity, royalty, and no doubt all this was spurred when the reality of the Holocaust unfolded. Not just the murder of 6 million Jews, many killed without physical resistance, but even more galling to him was the silence of American Jews, the establishment fear of rocking the boat, the reliance on government officials and their platitudes, especially including FDR, who for strange reasons remains a hero to Jews, despite his basic lack of interest in the fate of European Jewry, and even his frustration of rescue efforts, including not bombing the Auschwitz crematoria, but other things as well. So Kahana was part of a movement, small at first, that would take Jewish destiny into our own hands and not rely on princes and non-Jews. Years later, he was asked in an interview, how can a rabbi be arrested? You know, how's a rabbi protesting, demonstrating? We're the Rosh Yeshiva. And he would answer, why were no Jews arrested protesting in 1943? Where were the Rosh Yeshiva then? Passivity, dependence on others for our survival, does not work. What did the Holocaust mean to him? It meant that every attack on a Jew would be met with a counterattack, that every Jewish life and asset would be protected, that violence to protect Jews was a virtue, not a vice, and that the State of Israel is the place of Jewish destiny. If you want to understand everything that Americana stood for, look to the Holocaust. If you want to know why the establishment hated him, look to the Holocaust as well. They hated that he harped on their failures and their timidity. He left Beitar in 1951, joined Bnei Akiva. Holding up Beitar was meaningful until there was a Jewish state, but now that the state was established, it had to be infused with a Jewish character, and that was through Bnei Akiva. Torah Vavodo. He was a very charismatic leader in the Bnei Akiva. Rosh Sniff, or Rosh Ken, as they call it, emphasizing love of Torah, Israel, and Aliyah. Rabbi Rakefet, Rav Aaron Rakefet, and his wife Malka were two of his charges. And through Bnei Akiva, he met the woman who would become his wife, Libby as well, whom he married in 1956. She was 18, he was 24. It was love at first sight. Meanwhile, before then, he entered the Brooklyn College Night School in 1949. He began learning in Mir by day as well. Graduated college in 1954. 5 years for night school was actually pretty quick. Studied political science and history. Received smicha in 1955 from Rav Avram Kalmanovich, the Mir Rosh Yeshiva. Another great influence, because Rav Kalmanovich had been one of the most tireless activists during the Holocaust, focusing all his time on rescue efforts and violating the law if necessary. So Rav Kalmanovich himself rescued thousands of Jews by getting them visa, and he became the couple's Masada Kiddushin. Kahana then entered law school, New York Law School, simultaneously got a master's in international relations from New York University. So he got his law degree and master's in 1957, but he never took the bar, assuming he was making Aliyah right away. So he was sidetracked. And again, you see how history sometimes turns on the most interesting vignettes. In January 1958, armed with all his degrees, and a BA, a law degree, and a master's, he sailed to Israel to find a job and find a place to live for himself and his wife. So his daughter recalled, he told the story. En route to Israel by ship, he shared a cabin with seven other people, and one secular Jew walked in on Shabbos fuming because he had been up on the deck smoking a cigarette, and a chassid came and knocked the cigarette overboard. And this fellow walked into the room, the roommate was cursing all religious Jews. And then Meir Kahana would tell his children that when he was in yeshiva, he was once walking with his Rebbe on Shabbos, and they sat down on a park bench next to a smoker. The Rebbe realized the smoker was Jewish and said to him, "My friend, you probably forgot today is Shabbos." And the man threw away his cigarette. And Kahana said, "That's how you're supposed to talk to non-observant Jews." Israel wasn't as welcoming. He applied for a job in the foreign ministry, well-credentialed as he was, and he wasn't rejected, he was ignored, only because he wasn't a member of the Labor Party. Then he applied for a job as the rabbi of Kibbutz Sa'ad, and he didn't get it. His stuttering in English was controlled, but his stuttering in Hebrew at the time was uncontrollable. So rather than reject him, they also didn't answer him. But of such things history is made, he returned to New York, and he soon became the rabbi of the Howard Beach Jewish Center. There, before he took the job, he insisted they put in a mechitza, and they resigned from the United Synagogue, the conservative temple, and they agreed. While there, he posed two questions to Moshe Feinstein that we have as number one and number two. They found their way into Igris Moshe. B'kohen she'ein lo raglayim v'holech b'raglayim shasul and yinasiyas kapayim. This is from Kvodo, Milos Kvodo, Yedidi, Morena, Harav, Merkana, Shlito. The question was a Kohen had returned from fighting Korea missing a leg. He had a prosthetic device with a shoe at the bottom. And the question was, could a Kohen who takes off his shoes, could this person duchen? Moshe went through a whole air, I think we discussed it once on a Friday night here, and he said that the Kohen could duchen, otherwise it would turn him off completely, be depressed. The second tshuva was actually the same day it was sent, is actually prescient. He asked Reb Moshe about Chagigas Bas Mitzvah Beveis HaKnesses. So of course, his essence in the shul was Kiruv, and to draw the children in. So he wondered, if a boy is having a bar mitzvah, and of course it was a big event in temples and synagogues at the time, today as well, could they do the same thing for a girl? And Reb Moshe was not too keen on it, as we know, and he says it's not a sudas mitzvah, it's like a birthday, it's a reshus, you can't make it in shul, sudas reshus, but if they want to make a kiddush in shul, so that they can do. But this question too, it's in Orach Chaim Chelek Dalet Siman Lamed Vav, is on his name. He was successful in a way in his shul. The membership almost doubled in the first year, but he lasted only 3 years. They voted him out. He was unabashedly Orthodox, and he wrote and demonstrated that the non-Orthodox movements were not genuine and would lead Jews to assimilation and intermarriage. And of course he was right. And he emphasized especially teaching the children of the shul Torah. One thing his wife writes, he taught Arlo Guthrie, Woody Guthrie's son, for his bar mitzvah, because the mother was Jewish. But he taught children about kashrus and Shabbos. He sent some kids to Tiferes Moshe Elementary School in Queens, but then a rebellion started. The people in the shul, too many, resented the fact that the children were coming home and telling them they need to have only kosher kitchens. And they want to be in a Shomer Shabbos home. and the parents were afraid that children were coming too religious. And in 1961, they voted to remove the mechitza just to get rid of him because they knew he wouldn't stay. Apparently, the breaking point was when the president's son told his father that he's going to YU for college, and that did it. So although he was a hero in Mir, he gave up a job because of fidelity to Torah, something many rabbis did not do in those days. He turned to writing, and he became an editor at the Jewish Press, addressing the issues of the day, at first halachic topics, then public affairs. It became his primary source of income for most of his life, and the most he ever earned from the Jewish Press was $200 a week, which even in the 70s and 80s was really not that much money, but money he never had. His columns have been reprinted by the family. It's a 7-volume work. To read through them now is to see how prescient he was in so many areas. So what were the issues he addressed and confronted time after time, article after article? So we have a few here. One was non-orthodoxy, especially rabbis. If you turn the page to number 8, this is from 1961. I just cut it short at a particular point, but he said every person faces a moment of truth. It's called free will. It's often called the spirit that is man. It is also always called courage. It is not an easy thing for a man to give up a life of indolence. It's not a simple thing to ask him to turn his back upon a life of self-indulgence and material comforts. It's difficult for a simple person to choose greatness to leap for truth. It is much to ask a Jew to return to traditional Judaism. And yet he is asked to do precisely that. He is asked to destroy all that was in his past, to cast out his idols, to deny his creations, and to purge his soul, to look at the mirror of truth, to acquire his moment of truth. The non-observant Jew knows, deep in his heart, buried far away, in the inner recesses of his being, he knows. He knows that the path he trods is a false one, that the Judaism he professes is a mockery. He knows that the weird mixture of Sabbath desecration and high holy day synagogue attendance, the kosher home coupled with a meal at the Chinese restaurant, the neglect of prayer joined with strict yahrzeit observance, is a game, a children's game, which is full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. He knows, and then he went on and on. In a later article, number 5, I won't read the whole thing, many here will recall the television show Bridget Loves Bernie. Bridget and Bernie. Bridget, thank you. Bucky. Bridget Loves Bernie, about Bernie, a Jew, married to a non-Jew, Bridget, in the early 1970s, and he hated it, that it was canceled, and then he wrote about it, how relatively simple it was to cancel Bernie and Bridget on television, how much more difficult to struggle against the curse and cancer of intermarriage and assimilation that exists in real American Jewish life. And he goes on, what makes Bernie run? What makes Bernie run after Bridget? This is the question that drives the American Jewish establishment to frantically set up committees, study groups, surveys, and commissions. This is the question at the top of their puzzled order priorities. What makes Bernie run? She says, the puzzled shepherds can close down their study groups and their commissions. What makes Bernie run? Who created that Bernie? Why, the answer is obvious. The very same establishment groups who are busily creating the committees, commissions, study group surveys to find out the answer to these questions. These questions, by the way, because the point they underscore to society is the 11th commandment, the American Jew, thou shalt melt. Thou shalt melt, integrate, amalgamate, thou shalt be an American as all others. Well, this is 1973 or 4, he wrote this, and it's hard to say, it's not entirely true today, it's even worse today, but that is the way he wrote. Now, he criticized everybody at one time or another. He criticized critics of Israel, even praised Ben-Gurion when the Knesset passed a law permitting the incarceration of recalcitrant husbands. He wrote about tzniut becoming a dead letter among the modern Orthodox. He said, the minority is right, look outside. He wrote about presenting mitzvos in a positive way, So people should not think that orthodoxy is all about ancient rituals. He criticized talkers and he praised doers. He began speaking to youth and he became very popular. You know, in between jobs, he had a lot of side jobs. One year he bought a newspaper delivery route, delivered papers like from 5 to 7 in the morning, and then spent the rest of the day learning in yeshiva. When there was a strike in the newspapers in New York, he became a sports writer for the New York Daily News, writing under the name Martin Keen. Martin was his English name. And he criticized the yeshivas, including Meir, for teaching Torah in a dry, unimaginative, mechanical way that did not speak to the youth. By then, they were living in Laurelton, Libby and Meir Kahana. There's some Laurelton people here today as well. Around this time, rumor has it, he became an informant for the FBI under the name Michael King, infiltrating the John Birch Society and reporting on them. There are other lurid rumors as well, but none of that's corroborated, and he later in life had enough enemies that people could fabricate what they wanted in order to discredit him. It was during this period, the early 60s, he became involved in the two causes that would define his life in America, Soviet Jewry and Jewish self-defense. So what came first with Soviet Jewry was writing and speaking. And the activism followed. So who should get credit for the eventual liberation of Soviet Jews is a disputed question, but it's undeniable that Meir Kahana made it a public matter. It's undeniable as well that the Jews in the Soviet Union, many knew about it. Yosef Mendelevich, for example, said even in his time they knew all about Meir Kahana, what he was doing. Until then, the establishment either did nothing or acted around the margins. So the Jews of Silence, written by Elie Wiesel, published in 1965 after a visit to the Soviet Union, so he meant the Soviet Jews, but just as easily could have referred to American Jews. So Kahana decided on the only course of action that he thought had a chance of success, to make headlines, to draw publicity to the cause, to fire up a slumbering people that was still, even after the silence of the Holocaust years, timid, unsure of itself, not wanting to make waves. See, praise SSJ, one of the first organizations to get involved, the student struggle for Soviet Jewry, for picketing Soviet offices better than any other organization, but he said that picketing would not suffice. You have to get more attention. You have to have the politicians get involved. So pressure, arrests, harassment, and the threat of violence and harm would make an impact. He began already in 1963 to write and speak at rallies. And look at number three. I think it goes back to 1963. It is not, top left, not a pleasant task, but this is not a job for people who fear getting their hands soiled. Soviet Jewry will not wait upon respectability and gentility. It will mean condemnation from the respectable elements within Jewry who fear more for their own image than for Soviet Jewry. But neither is this a place for people who fear getting their reputations besmirched. And he goes on, he said the blacks were successful in gaining their civil rights because of the threat of violence that existed. It's interesting, I spoke last week to a long-time leader and a former activist in the JDL, who said to me that Kahana was always against violence. And interestingly, while he headed the JDL, no one ever got hurt unless there was a fight in the streets or seriously hurt. He felt that violence would be counterproductive, that rather than energize the American government to pressure the Soviets, it would subject Americans in Moscow, say, to similar violence. It would escalate the Cold War, and will push to the side the Soviet Jewry movement. So what he advocated was the threat of violence, feeling that if the threat was there without the actual violence, it would have a greater effect. So routine harassment, Soviet offices occupied, Aeroflot's offices, cultural missions, accosting diplomats on the street, bomb scares, smoke bombs, stink bombs, the most egregious while he was there, shooting into a diplomat's home in the Bronx, but again in an empty part of the home. No one was hurt, but the arrest became routine. the blocking of traffic and other acts, all really theater annoyances that got attention, publicity, and always with the threat that things could get out of hand if the treatment of Soviet Jews did not improve and they were not allowed to emigrate. His stated goal was to poison the atmosphere between the U.S. and the USSR. So in that vein, interestingly enough, he toured campuses in the mid-1960s as the head of another organization he started, trying to drum up support for the Vietnam War. Talk about a contrarian. Going to college campuses in the 60s to encourage people to support the Vietnam War because he felt that would weaken the Soviets. Now, people always debate how instrumental he was there another way, etc. My own sense is that he brought the plight of Soviet Jewry not only to the masses, the media, and the government, but to the Jewish establishment as well. And the latter never forgave him for it. Acting alone, it's not only him, because he was never that sensitive to the political dynamics. You know, he would push people, but he could never be the Makeh Bepatish. It's analogous question, by the way, to the Irgun. Would Israel have been established without the Irgun pressure on the British? Maybe, but not when it was, probably much later, if at all. See, his contributions to the cause made a difference. They were well known in the Soviet Union as well as to Soviet Jews. Few of the rabbis were as engaged in that process as he was. And it's true, in 1971-72, when they're at their heyday, and because of the encroaching detente between Nixon and Brezhnev, tens of thousands of Jews were allowed to emigrate from the Soviet Union. But he was routinely barred, even arrested, but barred from the establishment Soviet Jewry conferences that took place around the world. He would go anyway, force himself in. He'd be arrested as well. He'd probably be arrested hundreds of times. Of course, even the threat of violence is playing with fire. So in January 1972, an incendiary bomb exploded in the office of Saul Yurok, the Jewish impresario brought Soviet Russian acts like the Bolshoi to New York, and a Jewish secretary, Iris Konis, was killed. So poor chroniclers of history blame this on Kahana, but by this time he was living in Israel over a year already. In fact, that week he was celebrating his son Baruch's bar mitzvah in Israel. He was no longer involved in the daily management of the JDL, and he denounced this attack as an insane act because it really was... It hurts the cause, not help the cause. Three JDLers were arrested for it. It was obviously, nonetheless, a stain on his record and the movement, even if he was not involved. But if you call him a murderer, that already is a calumny because he was not involved. Didn't even know about it before it happened, as frequently happened as well. It would be like blaming every supporter of the OU if the OU stumbles once in Kashrus and Trafe chickens get out there. That makes no sense. But it is true, those who play with fire eventually get burnt. Now, the strike force for the Soviet Jewry movement became the JDL, and the JDL really made his reputation. Part of their mandate was the Soviet Jewry movement, but it began for another reason entirely. In 1967-68, American cities were plagued by the rioting of blacks and incessant attacks on defenseless Jews. What was happening was what Jews, unaffected by it, euphemistically called, the neighborhood is changing. And places where Jews lived for decades, even Harlem, but mostly Brooklyn neighborhoods, Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brownsville and others, became inhospitable to Jews. Most Jews fled. The ones who stayed suffered. At the same time, Jewish teachers were being threatened in their public schools, and the jobs were under attack because black groups objected to the disproportionate number of Jews in the school. In July 1968, after months of articles in the Jewish press, the JDL was formed. If you look at number 7, here's the original JDL manifesto. Then it was called the beginning, JEDL. It's not a racist organization. It's neither right nor left in its philosophy. JDL rejects all hate and illegality. It fights the revolutionary left, so hostile to Jewish continuity in the state of Israel, even today. combats the cancer of right fascism, stands up to the black Nazi, believes in law and order, backs the police forces, special project, the youth of this country, Jewish youth in particular, bring to them the facts and truths of the hearts that troops would impose. And it goes on with the other aspects of its platform. And you see at the bottom, the big advertisement ended, dedicated to the 6 million with our pledge, never again. It attracted at first hundreds of members, later perhaps in the low thousands. It would march, it would protest, it would carry legal weapons, it would defend Jews in the inner cities. The muscle was affectionately nicknamed the Chaya Squad. And it was summarized, their whole platform was summarized by that slogan, never again, which, as Kahana often stated, when it was co-opted by the establishment, it never meant that a Holocaust could never happen again. That he called, I quote, an absurd proposition. It meant that there would never again be, I quote, that same lack of reaction, that same indifference, that same fear to attacks on any Jew anywhere. As strange as it sounds, the Jewish establishment hated it, and hated more its involvement in the Soviet Jewry movement. They might have thought it wouldn't work, it would provoke more violence, that there must be a better way to be determined. But as we've seen very often, sometimes when people say there must be a better way to be determined, they never quite get around to determining what that better way is. So JDL made Kahana something of a pariah in the Jewish establishment, and that type of oppositionist mentality still prevails. I'll give you an example. After, you see the difference in worldview after the Pittsburgh massacre a few weeks ago, when President Trump said the shul, the synagogue, like all houses of worship, should have an armed guard, all right? The reaction of liberal Jews was fast and furious, apoplectic. It was not just blaming the victim, a preposterous claim, or hatred of Trump, but one female reconstructionist rabbi, I don't want to say her name, expressing her strong opposition to the very idea that there should be Jews with guns in shul, said, if we let them change the way we pray, then we let them change our whole religion. Well, I guess the irony escaped her. Her entire movement changed the whole religion. Kahana said differently, every Jew at 22, we have to defend ourselves first and foremost. And notice as well another modern phenomenon. The ADL reports, somewhat breathlessly and a tad exaggerated, that anti-Jewish incidents are at an all-time high or whatever. So they report, they raise money off it. What they don't suggest is Jewish self-defense. They want to end hatred as an emotion. It's a dubious and impossible task. It's actually quite Christian, but it's never worked. Kahana wanted to end the haters, not the hatred, or at least keep them far from Jews out of fear of what might happen to them. So you can decide what works better. I'll mention one point that again shows the contrast. In 1975, a Jew in Brooklyn was mugged and killed, Rahman al-Islam, on Shabbos, because he didn't have any money on him. And two leading modern Orthodox rabbis, I won't say their names, decided to discuss and put forward the idea that Jews should be allowed to carry money on Shabbos in order to pay off muggers. And Kahana mocked them, because obviously there's some other things you can carry to ward off muggers, but the thought did not occur to them. Now, an understated aspect of the JDL was its Kiruv effect. Young Jews who were often far from Torah observance gained purpose, a connection, and a Rebbe, how many thousands called him Reb up to the time of his death, and a bond with the Jewish people through a sense of Ahavat Yisrael for which they would put their bodies on the line. So he established Camp Jeddel. He ran leadership training seminars to train young Jews in his Torah and his thought and what and how they could do to help Jews. Nuts and bolts, how to run a demonstration, how to write a press release in addition to the ideology. He did this in America, did this in Israel as well. He was convicted in 1971 for possession of explosives. He was demonstrating explosives at Camp Jeddah under the supervision of an explosives expert, but apparently was illegal anyway. He was sentenced to probation, but he was eventually sent to jail a few years later for almost a year for violating probation, in that he was accused of fomenting violence from Israel in asking his followers to, quote, do anything necessary to upset the visit to the United States of Leonid Brezhnev. He was already living in Israel, but two things came out of his time in Allenwood. One, he wrote a sefer. And two, he sued the government for the right to kosher food, and he won. Now, I want to just quote a few things here that are of interest. First, number 9 is his statement to the judge before sentencing. He said, "I am not happy being here, even though you are only a judge of flesh and blood. I do not look forward to being put in prison, although that may work, may very well be, but someday I'll have to face a second judge. And with him there will be, I believe, a great many souls. I believe those souls stand by his side, and when every Jew comes, they have a question they pose to the soul that has just arrived, and that question is, where were you when we cried out? Those are the souls of the Jews of Eastern Europe's Holocaust, and they will also be the souls of the Jews of the USSR. I want to be able to say I was there and I did what I could. I've tried to do what I can, and whether I go to prison or I do or not, I'm going to continue doing what I have to do, and I only hope that the members of the Jewish Defense League and all Jews, no matter what happens this morning, will do what they have to do. Thank you." His wife was in Israel. She wanted to come for the duration of his sentence, but he sent to number 10 a loving note. "Dear Lib, I hope you understand why I do not want you to come to America. Aside from there being no point to it, the children need you there, and I want to put into practice the concept that the Jew has no place in the Galut, and that there's no reason to leave Eretz Yisrael unless there's the direst of circumstances, which this is not." He explained logically, "I miss you very much, but I will not miss you less if you come here for a week." Well, he sued and he won, and here's the caption from number 11, United States versus Kahana. So it's so interesting. Judge Weinstein, who sentenced him, allowed him to remain out. He got out for sometimes 3, 5, even 9 hours a day because the prison could not give him kosher food. He's allowed to be out. He's in a halfway house, and he could leave, come back at night, and take care of his needs until, in fact, the court ruled in his favor that if the government is going to imprison Orthodox Jews, they have to provide for their kosher food needs as well. Every Jew in prison who gets kosher food should thank Mayor Kahana for this. Of course, it's still better not to be in prison. He would do anything to help Jews. In 1971, he established a brief working relationship with Joe Colombo, who was head of one of the 5 mafia families in New York. Alas, he was soon after gunned down. In 1969, needing money, he began to teach at YHSQ, where the students described him as charismatic, and as the rabbi in Rochdale Village, again in Queens, but neither job lasted long as he embarked on a new campaign, and that was Aliyah. It's safe to say that few rabbis were involved in public policy issues as much as he was. And the issues he took on were always hot-button issues. He was one of the leading debaters of the Reform and Conservative. As I mentioned, saw them as illegitimate and leading their followers, good Jews but naive, down the path to intermarriage and assimilation. And his articles of the Jewish press ran the gamut of issues: Torah, Israel, Soviet Jewry, non-Orthodoxy, politics, race relations, intermarriage, and especially the empty materialism that he said clogged the spiritual arteries of American Jewry. So in his writing, he could be sarcastic and cynical and biting and funny and punny, he loved puns, moving, sentimental, but the issues he addressed as a rabbi writing are broader, were broader and more penetrating than any of his contemporaries. He spoke on numerous college campuses, often to hostile audiences, but you watch the videos, they're on YouTube. See the crowds, gauge their level of interest, their engagement, and their response to his call, that the most important thing in their lives was their Jewishness, and they should appreciate it and take advantage of it. And then he began writing and speaking about Aliyah. always difficult for American rabbis because we're here. He wrote a book with a title. You can judge a book by the title, by the way. Uncomfortable Questions for Comfortable Jews, among his 40 books. Another, you get right to the point on the cover, Time to Go Home. So he and his family made Aliyah in 1971, but he did return to the U.S. frequently to speak. In May 1972, he hosted a mass Aliyah conference on Long Island as the only hope for American Jewry. So he lived for a time in Yerushalayim, and then after a few years, he and his wife moved to Kiryat Arba, where he remained until his end. He never really had any money, nor did he complain about it at all. I want to just quote a brief passage from Or HaRayon, which is really an encyclopedic work that takes up 40, 50 different areas of Judaism. It says number 13 here, page Tuf Lamed Dalid. And he speaks about living the exile and the natural home of a Jew is in Israel. Yisrael hayoshvim b'tumar agalut, Jews who live in the impurity of the exile, u'mo'asim b'kach b'eretz chemdo b'kedushat ha'aretz, and they scorn the desirable land and the holiness of the land, mechalim et shmo shakadosh baruch hu b'etzem yeshivatam b'kerv agoyim. They defile, they desecrate God's name by the mere fact they're living amongst the Gentiles, tachar ol agoyim ribonutam, under the yoke of the Gentiles and their sovereignty. And they depend on them. All right, he doesn't mince words. You could read it. It gets even a little more harsh. But nonetheless, he left nothing unsaid if he felt it needed to be said. But Israel, even in Israel, he remained a thorn in the side of the establishment. He was perceived as a leader. He was a known entity in Israel already because of the JDL, the Soviet Jewry movement. He was offered a place in Likud, but he turned it down. He even started JDL in Israel until they arrested and reminded him there's an army and a police force. So that did that. But he could not harness himself to any establishment. It was both his great strength and his great weakness. His issues remain similar with the addition of somewhat unique to Israel, Jewish pride, Jewish identity. He lambasted the labor establishment that had rejected him 15 years earlier for the spiritual massacre they had committed against Sephardic Jews in the early 1950s. Opposition to any territorial concessions, and then the need to transfer hostile Arabs from the land of Israel for the security of the state and people. Every act of terror was like a dagger in his side, and his book on the issue was simply titled They Must Go. And he initiated a series of protests and arrests. He was arrested multiple times in Israel. One joke he told, he was treated very roughly by the Israeli police, and he complained to them that even in America he was never manhandled this much. And they said to him, that's because here we don't have to worry about the Jewish vote. It was a joke that he told. He was such a critic of the Israeli government of Golda Meir that the Jewish press began censoring some of his articles, saying it was providing fodder for Israel haters. He refused to moderate his views one iota, even to sell them in political campaigns. He maintained that there always has to be at least one party that speaks the absolute truth. If he disagreed with Likud or the National Religious Party, Mafdal, on one point, that was enough. Even asked to present his views on transfer in more temperate tones, he refused. Harking back to the activism days, the more outlandish, the more the publicity, but of course very often, the less effective you are. And this became a recurring issue. At one point, the Israeli government confiscated his passport, depriving him of the opportunity to visit the U.S., his American passport they took, and the Israeli passport. So friends enlisted the support of Rav Moshe Feinstein, who called the Israeli consul on his behalf. And this is a part of the Meir Kahana story that's underappreciated. He was an extremist, of course, but extremism in defense of Torah and Jews and Israel. So even if Gedolim could find fault with his tactics, his objectives were always admirable, as opposed to the secular Jewish establishment that opposed both his tactics and his objectives. So for example, he first ran for the Knesset in 1973, came very close to getting in, lost by 2,500 votes,
But he did worse in 1977, having been out of the country for a longer period of time, including in jail. But and he was also being arrested consistently in Israel. But when he ran in 1977, he was actually endorsed by Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cohen Cook, who spoke very highly of Rav Kahana and his ideas. And I'll quote in English. "The presence of Rabbi Meir Kahana and his uncompromising words from the Knesset platform will undoubtedly add strength and value to the obligatory struggle on behalf of the entire land of Israel, even if Tzvi Yehuda apparently withdrew the endorsement under pressure from the Maftal." Had Kahana won in 1973, who knows if his life would have taken a different turn. He was close from Mordechai Eliyahu to Shlomo Kalbach. They did work together also in the 70s and 80s. To Rabbi Yisrael Ariel, who was that mystery number two on his list. Today he heads the Mechana Mikdash Yerushalayim, and others. There are others, other American rabbis, famous names, moderates, who saw him as a resource, didn't shun him, but tried to guide him to do good in a way that would be acceptable to all. Many self-styled liberals tried to deprive him of his right to free speech, something that is now de rigueur, but first starting in the 1980s. See, enlisted in the IDF, he could have gotten away with some pro forma service because he was in his 40s already, but he insisted that basic training and then Miluim, his brief service in Ramallah in 1982, was also legendary. The Arabs were told he was coming and they were so afraid of him, they stayed inside their homes. See, he remained vocal on all the issues of the day in America, in Israel, even though he formally stepped down from the JDL in the early 1970s, uninvolved in day-to-day affairs from 71 on, but he formally resigned in 74, and the organization, within a few years, was a non-entity. But he kept fighting. He fought against the Nazis marching in Skokie. He turned on his hero Menachem Begin because of the Camp David Accords. He fought against the withdrawal of Sinai, from Sinai and Yamit, even though he was called back from America by a general because some of the remaining settlers in Yamit had threatened a mass suicide. They flew Kahana in to Israel, then on a military helicopter to Yamit. He should talk to them and talk them out of committing any rash acts. He wound up in administrative detention several times for months at a time. He was often prescient, but not every prediction was on target. So for example, unless you think of the long term, In 1979, he opened in the Kach headquarters on Rehovot Sishi near Yerushalayim the Museum of the Potential Holocaust about the coming destruction of American Jewry. So I visited twice, I have to tell you. I found it a bit overwrought, exaggerating the influence of neo-Nazis in American society. He thought American Jewry had barely a decade. So now it's four decades later. Draw whatever conclusion you want. Doesn't mean it can happen, but it hasn't happened. Nor is it on the horizon. He wrote a book in 1986 called 40 Years, that 1988 was the decision time for Israel to one direction or another. It wasn't. But in Israel, he finally won a Knesset seat in 1984 as leader of the Kach party. Now, people focus on only one part of the platform, transfer, but the Kach platform endorsed everything that Kahana had been advocating for years. Torah, mitzvos, Jewish identity, love of all Jews, settlement, Soviet Jewry, etc. But he became famous or infamous for the transfer plan. It offended the left-wingers' humanism and dreams of peace and coexistence, and offended the right-wing parties, mainly because of the potential for loss of votes. Remember when Rehavam Zevi, Hashem Yikom Damo Gandhi, embraced transfer as the platform for his Moledet party just a few years later, somehow he wasn't deemed a racist, nor was he banned, although he was also murdered. In fact, Gandhi, with his transfer plan, was a minister in the government. So taking all the emotion and the high-sounding talk out of it, the cold facts are that population transfers have a long history to them and have worked to reduce strife and violence between two warring peoples. So for example, after World War II, almost 12 million ethnic Germans were driven out of Eastern and Central Europe. Perhaps 2 million died in their travel west. In 1948, almost 13 million Hindus and Muslims exchange places in India and Pakistan. And the political argument can be made, as some did, that the Middle East saw an incomplete transfer. 800,000 Jews were expelled from Muslim lands and absorbed by Israel. About half the Arabs in Israel fled, a quarter million remained, but full transfer was never completed. So it was plausible, it's a little difficult to digest, immoral to some minds, but much more moral to others if it avoids constant friction and terror and violence and death. Whatever the merits, certainly debatable in light of history, it made Kana a pariah, and it's still on the agenda, but very understated, and I don't see a political way to carry it out, even if people would deem it the right way. Now, once he was elected, President Herzog refused to meet with him, breaking with precedent. He met with all the party leaders, even Arab terrorists. So Kahana returned the favor, calling Herzog in public, Chometz ben Yayin, vinegar the son of wine, meaning a bad son to an illustrious father. But you have this very interesting letter in number 12 that was made aware by Rabbi Rakefet a few weeks ago, or a few months ago. It was a letter that Rav Soloveitchik wrote in November 1984 to President Herzog, calling for him, asking him, it was on YU stationery, asking him to meet with Kahana. And he says, "Hinni mevin ki chvado mitameis anhig atzmo tafigido haram berov tov chachma." He says, "I know, I understand, you try to do everything with the wisdom, and there are many different calculations you have. Afa pichain tamar b'fi. I have a bitter taste in my mouth. V'gam lo yuz barley. It's not understandable to me. Lama haya alav lazmin nitzigei hamiflaga nitzigei Arafat v'chevem eratzchov. Why do you invite to meet with you the representatives of Arafat and his band of murderers, Umein lahazmin at Rabbi Kahana, Nehru, and you don't invite Rabbi Kahana? And you know that he's roughly not impressed and involved in politics, etc. But he says, it's four lines from the bottom of the first paragraph, Im kein, heyot v'amer Kahana, shu k'tzat tamid chacham, little tamid chacham, lamrot kamim v'kamim yishigon atav, notwithstanding some of his, you know, madness. Who Yehudi Yirei Shemayim? Hanocham l'Torah ulechod Shem Shemayim lechod Yisrael. He's a God-fearing Jew who fights for Torah, the honor of heaven, and the honor of the Jewish people. Ein chas v'shalom l'ashvotel l'gruim shebein porkeah olvachay Yisrael. You can't compare him, God forbid, to the inferior people who throw off the yoke of Torah. And he said, I'm writing to you directly, so you shouldn't hear different things in my name, you know, from my Talmidim here and there. And he says, Lu ayoshomei alatzati, if you listen to my advice, and you now invite Kahana, ki balmeretz umesiras nefesh kazo yesh l'matein v'oz yoel l'ha'il. If you invite Kahana, who is a courageous person, and he has his courage and his enthusiasm and his mesiras nefesh just need to be moderated, and then it'll be beneficial. Then everyone benefits. And then, by the way, he called upon President Herzog to be a shomer mitzvahs in public, to respect the state and respect his father as well. Well, the plea was turned down. This was found in the archives of Chaim Herzog. Kahana would constantly boast that his support was growing, and there were polls that indicated he would get 3 seats, 4, 6, as much as 13. He happened to have been a diligent legislator in the 4 years he was almost never missing a session, but with few accomplishments because he had no support. And to him it was clear, he said it openly, Israel should be a state of halacha, something that frightened everyone, even the religious parties, for reasons they should explain. Now the reaction to him corrupted Israeli democracy in ways that led to some of the excesses of the next 20 years and the utter disregard, even contempt for minority views. For example, the Knesset passed a law in 1984 that no one with a foreign passport could be a member of the Knesset. It was just a law that would force him to give up his American passport. And he did. Knesset passed an anti-racism law in 1985, which eventually the Supreme Court upheld, resulting in the banning of the Kach Party in 1988. No other party was subject, even the Arab parties who call for Israel's extermination. They're not subject to it. So they just passed laws to stick it to him. He still traveled, spoke, wrote, but it was a terrible blow, one that he thought would eventually be reversed. And once this happened, that he was deemed a racist by the Knesset, so shuls in America started banning him as well, even places where he had frequently spoken in the future. He started a yeshiva in Israel that still exists, Yeshivat Or HaRayon, the light of the idea. He wrote that sefer, I quoted before, or a comprehensive book on the Jewish idea, ranging from Omachu Shemaim and Avas Hashem and Avas Yisrael, laws of war, Israel, Mashiach, Gogu Magog, role of non-Jews, Kiddush Hashem, and many others. It really is an encyclopedia. November 5th, 1990, speaking to Jews in the Marriott Hotel on the east side of Manhattan, he was shot in the head by El Sayyid Nasser. Kahana had refused any special security. His funeral the next day in Brooklyn at the Young Israel Ocean Parkway attracted thousands. It was a cold day. I was there myself. Rabbi Tendler was one of those who eulogized him, saying that Meir Kahana had one objective in life. How do you make each Jew stand tall? And his burial in Israel, Har Nuchot, attracted thousands more. But nothing came easy. And even in death, he had what to teach. El Sayyid Nasser, if you remember, was acquitted by a Manhattan jury of homicide, convicted only of possession of a gun, even though he was shot at the scene and arrested right outside. So much for justice. He was later retried on federal grounds of violating Americana's civil rights by killing him, and he was convicted of that. That's why he now has a life sentence, although he did come up for parole, which was denied a few months ago. But you can trace a straight line between the Arab terrorist cell that killed Kahana, that blew up the World Trade Center in 1993, and that flew planes into the Twin Towers on September 11th, 2001. There was tremendous overlap in the group, from Nasser to the blind Sheikh to Bin Laden. So many today say that this was the first act of Arab terror on American soil, the assassination of Meir Kahana, and had the authorities been more astute, the later terror could have been averted. So obviously he died al Kiddush Hashem, and his legion of critics should therefore be duly cautious in evaluating his life. He and Libby had four children, many grandchildren. His son, Binyamin Zev, and his wife, Talia, Hashem Kom Damam, were murdered December 31st, 2000, on their way home to Tapuach on Kvish Yishim. It's a settlement in the Shomron that has many Kachlikim. It was founded by Kach. That was part of the Arab wave of terror that was so predictable and which evoked a lot of wringing of the hands. No, so how would history have been different if he had lived? Think about it. It's always the fate of the young. Meir Kahana would be 86 today had he lived. Someone suggested to me last week that Baruch Goldstein would never have murdered Arabs in 1994 had his teacher remained alive. Would Oslo, of course we'll never know, would Oslo have unfolded as it did? Would the expulsion from Gaza have taken place as it did? There was opposition, but nothing like Meir Kahana could have done as a charismatic leader, as one who put his life on the line for Jews. Who knows? His ideas still live on, the good and the challenging. His collected writings, mainly his columns, can be read today and are still relevant to the modern debate and not historical curiosities. What was always clear to me, besides the passion, was the breadth, the range of issues he discussed. His fiery public personality combined with a warm and loving inner spirit that made him unique in the 20th century rabbinate. And he did have a tart tongue. Number 14 is an interview he gave the day of his death that was published a few days later. The questioner said, "I must return to a previous point, since so many people raise it. The lies and defamation and attacks on you must surely wear you down. How do you cope with it?" I answered that at least in part, but let me add a bit to that. To begin with, one rule is basic. Never respond to vicious and filthy lies that are clear attempts to defame and destroy and that are funded and planned by enemies of the Jewish people. when one responds to these things, that is exactly what the enemy wants, since it only helps to publicize the defamation. When one gets into the mud with the swine, one must emerge filthy. King David said, "They who hate me without reason are more than the hairs of my head." But he also taught us how to react to the haters. "I will keep a curb on my mouth while the wicked one is before me." And then, classic Kahana, "In a word, one does not bark back at barking dogs if one is a person and not a dog." No one else achieved what he did, not the successes, not the failures. But he did light a fire under American and Israeli Jewry that still burns, or at least flickers. No one replaced him. And so his movements suffered in his absence. But as a leader and lover of Jews, it's hard to find his equal. And there's some sense of unfinished business, natural when someone dies at 58. But had he moderated even a little, worked with others, rather than always against, maybe would have impacted the world practically rather than just ideologically or rhetorically. But it's hard to think of another rabbi who took on the issues he did and that animated so many people with the love of Jews that he had.
All right, folks, I hope you enjoyed Rabbi Stephen Przanski. He is a rock star. Check out his blog, rabbiprzanski.com. He's got many, many issues that he deals with and a lot of great shiurim, a lot of great classes in history and in Torah. And that's also the end for the Yishai Fleischer Show. I want to thank the good people that make this show possible. First thing, it's you, folks who are listening, who care, and folks who are donating, who care, who are part of the project. Check out YishaiFleischer.com. Remember, Giving Tuesday is coming up, so give, because it's Giving Tuesday, duh. And also, I want to thank the folks that sponsor the show. I want to thank the Tchelet folks, the True Blue Jew String. Okay, string them up. Okay, that's the way we got to do. We got to have a blue string. String up your guitar with the blue strings and let it tune your life. And check out Tchelet, T-E-K-H-E-L-E-T.com. Check out Hebron Fund.org. And that is the organization that's going to bring you to Hebron, connect you with the mothers and fathers. Hebronfund.org. We have a great tour every Wednesday from the David Citadel Hotel, run by the incredible Rabbi Simcha Hochbaum. And also, that's HebronFund.org. And also, check out our new sponsor, The Israel Bible, TheIsraelBible.com. Right now, The Israel Bible is on sale for the holiday season. Check it out, The Israel Bible. Get it. You'll love it. You're going to live with it. It's going to live with you. You're going to learn from it. It's going to teach you the ways of life with a lot of wise people who commented on it and Rabbi Tully Weiss, who edited it. Check it out at The Israel Bible. In any case, folks, that's the end of our show. And most important is that you connect with not just The Israel Bible, not just Hebron Fund, not Tchelet.com, but really with the Bible itself, with Hebron itself, with Tchelet itself, with God himself, with his great story, with the forefathers and mothers. That's what we're all about. Write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. And I also want to thank Ben Bresky for editing. I want to thank Tabitha for getting it out there and for Moshe Herman for producing the show. Thank you very much for being with me. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected. Be part of this great story. Something amazing is happening and you are a part of it when you're listening to this show. Write me an email, send me hashtag, I'm a part of it. Be a part of it wherever you are. God bless you. Shabbat Shalom.
Torah thoughts and inspiration from the heartland of Israel. Tune in every week to The Soul of Israel with Rabbi Shlomo Katz on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.